Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink a beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and lock me up and throw away the key, or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away, huh. But I feel alright, I feel alright tonight. I feel alright tonight. And I'll bring you precious contraband and ancient tales from distant lands.
All right, all right, all right. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live. Excuse me. Wow. We are live in the WGN Skyline studio here. Until 5 a.m., I am your overnight dude every weekday morning, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich follows with the opening bell, and Steve Cochran as your morning drive at 6. It's Tuesday. That means two for Tuesday. You mean two for Tuesday? I get your requests in now. It's one artist, two songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200, two for Tuesday. That's also for texts and phone calls if you want to jump in anytime we're having a conversation here this morning, on this Tuesday morning. Joining me after the 1:30 news is Kitty Coran. She is the co-author of a book called For Your Consideration, Keanu Reeves, which is a terrific book. And if you're a Keanu Reeves fan, this is really fantastic, fantastic stuff filled with trivia and stories and all kinds of really cool stuff and great, great little illustrations. And, it's a really fun book. We're going to talk with Kitty Coran, who is also an illustrator. But she didn't illustrate the stuff in the Keanu Reeves book. But we'll talk about that. And as you know, if you're a regular listener to this show, you know I am a Keanu Reeves fan. Always have been, always will be. So there it is. Also coming up, we're going to talk about weirdest sports superstitions. Athletes are weird. And they do weird stuff. And there's also fans are weird. And we do weird stuff. Like weird superstitions to make sure we win, or, you know, wear the same pair of shorts 8 games in a row because you're on a 7-game winning streak. So that kind of thing. And the LA Kings declare Taylor Swift a jinx. Now, I'd heard about this story, Tom, but I'm not really familiar with the details. I saw it in passing. It's pretty goofy, right?
Yeah, so essentially the LA Kings realize, and some of their fans realize, that there's this banner up where the Kings play. I think it was like advertising Taylor Swift being at the arena, and
at Staples Center. Yeah.
And they noticed that when it's being displayed, they lose, and when it's covered up, they win. So they've been leaving it covered up.
That's what I'm talking about, man. Yeah, don't jinx it. Even if you think it's silly and it's stupid superstition, you don't want to take a chance.
Hopefully T Swizzle isn't too upset about
it. T Swizzle. By the way, also, Fleetwood Mac's album Tusk turned 40 a few days ago. 40 years old, Tusk. So we're going to talk about that album and how weird it is. And it's just a crazy follow-up to Rumors. And then we're going to talk about the best Fleetwood Mac songs and talk a little about Fleetwood Mac. Speaking of hockey, Blackhawks played last night. They won! And they looked good!
Exactly.
And Corey looked great in the net. He missed the no-no because it was 6-on-4 when they scored. You know what I mean? It was a late penalty in the game. So they had a 6-on-4 going. So it's not easy for Corey to do that. But I would love to have seen him get a shutout. But anyway, Hawks won. They won 3-1.
A win is a win.
We'll play the Blackhawks Express later on in the show as well, right towards the end of the show. We'll always play the Blackhawks Express the morning after a game. And they looked good, man. They did. It was really nice to see them win. You know, after an 0-2-1 start, Yeah, it was a good game. It was fun. So you know, Goodfellas originally had poor test screenings, and then they did some test screenings, and we also have a bunch of movies that were changed because of test screenings. So yeah, this is something that James L. Brooks knows all too much. You've seen the movie I'll Do Anything?
Yeah, I have.
Yeah.
A lot of changes?
Yeah, it was once a musical.
Really?
With music by Sinead O'Connor and Prince.
And the test screening just said, no.
Oh, no. Yeah. And what's weird is that the movie is about making movies and test screenings. But they changed it. It was a musical. It was a full-on musical. Like Nick Nolte singing. You know? Albert Brooks singing. So the test screenings, he cut all the songs out. Mm-hmm. And there, I mean, like, it was two other really great songwriters in addition to Sinead O'Connor and Prince, who wrote original music for that movie. So yeah, test screenings can be...
They can be brutal and they can matter a lot.
Yeah. Yes, they can. But James L. Brooks is one of those guys who will change his movies. He does test screenings pretty religiously. He hates them, but he does them pretty regularly. So anyway, we can get into that too. By the way, have you been reading the early press on The Irishman?
I've tried to stay a little bit away from it because I just want to experience it. I know the broad strokes of what I know it involves. It's Jimmy Hoffa.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
all that kind of stuff.
I'm just talking about the reaction.
Yeah. No, I've been trying to.
It's been insane. Seriously insane. And it's like 3.5 hours long. It's a 3.5 hour movie, gangster movie, involving Jimmy Hoffa with Pacino, De Niro, Pesci, directed by Martin Scorsese, written by Steven Zaillian.
It's an all-star show.
The press for it has been ridiculous. Like, people are like, this is like Scorsese's best movie in like 30 years. So,
I mean, what I am curious about, obviously there's the diehards out there and people, I mean, if you know Goodfellas, you have to watch this because it's got Pesci in it. It's got De Niro, Scorsese, all that good stuff. But I wonder, in terms of younger people who might not be as familiar with Goodfellas or as familiar with Scorsese, other than he was ripping on Marvel movies a little bit.
Yeah.
I wonder if they'll sit down and watch a 3.5 hour gangster movie. I mean, this is going to be, you can't really go to the theaters and see it. There'll be some places showing it, limited engagements, all that kind of stuff.
There are some places they're going to show it. It's mostly going to be seen on Netflix.
How much are people at home realistically going to sit down and watch
that? I
don't
know. I can't wait.
Yeah.
I personally cannot wait till that thing comes out.
Hey, man, you're preaching to the choir.
Man.
I'm just very curious to see how younger audiences react to that.
That's legit. So. All right. So that's Tom, who's producing. Tom Hush, the great Tom Hush, producing the show this morning. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning to you, Nick.
And in the newsroom, it's Vic Vaughn. Vic, how are you?
I am very well.
Good for you.
It is good for me.
Yeah. How about them Hawks, though?
Right?
Yeah.
How about them Hawks? And how about them Packers? Woohoo!
Oh, boy.
Stop.
Hey, did something controversial happen during that game? Because my social media lit up about the referees.
Yeah, I missed the game. I was walking from my apartment to here, and they were losing, and then I got to the newsroom, and they had won. So I don't know what happened, but there's some controversy. I'm seeing a lot of tweets about it.
Now, do you just have to say woo-hoo for the Green Bay Packers because you live with Jeannie? Is that why you have to do that?
I don't have to do it. It's out of courtesy because I was trash-talking before I left, and then I have to eat, you know, my words now.
Aaron Rodgers, man.
I know.
You know, what do you could say about that guy? there were some really bad calls during the game because, like, seriously, people who were watching the game on my news feed went nuts. Like, they were screaming about, this is the worst refereed game I've ever seen. Like, not just one or two bad calls, like several.
Yeah, that's what I'm seeing, too. I saw one tweet that said, good news is, in 5 billion years, the sun will explode and evaporate the earth and all, all
referees.
Evidence of this game ever happening.
Yeah. Well, so, who
must have been pretty bad.
The
Lions.
They played the Lions. So because somebody said Detroit got screwed on a bunch of calls.
Yeah, I'm seeing the same thing. I haven't seen that game yet, though. I recorded it, so I'm going to go home and watch it in the morning.
All right. Well, keep an eye out for it, and let me know tomorrow if the referees, because it seemed like everybody I know who watches football was losing their mind during the game. So I don't know. You didn't watch the game, did you?
No, not much of a Packers fan, nor a Motor City Kitties fan, so.
Barry Sanders tweeted about it, too.
He did?
Mm-hmm.
That's how you
former
know
running back
yeah,
for the Lions
yeah.
back in the day. So
wow.
He even tweeted something about they need to change these rules. So, I don't know what happened,
okay.
But I'll go watch
all
it in the morning.
Maybe some people have watched it. I don't know. I watched the Hawks.
there seems to be an increase in dissatisfaction with NFL referees over the last few years.
Some of them are doing really well
sure.
this year too.
Yeah. Well, all right. So there's a little controversy in the Monday Night Football game. So there it is. All right. Well, Packers won. It was in very dramatic fashion because I was watching the news before I left for work, and they showed like the final play. And I guess it was a very dramatic fact. They won like 23-21.
23-22.
Wow. All right. Well, there you go. Hey, there's your sports. And we will play a Blackhawks Express later on in the show. And a good one, too. So there you go. All right. When we come back, I want to talk. Tom and I have not talked on the air about this new animated show called Primal. Dan Feinberg, who's going to be on Thursday, right?
Correct, yeah.
Dan's going to be on Thursday. Dan mentioned it during his last visit and said he loved it and said it was great. If anybody watched it, it's on Adult Swim, on the Cartoon Network, on Adult Swim. I'd love to hear from you, from talk or text, 312-981-7200. I thought it was unbelievable. I mean, seriously, I thought it was so great. I mean, really, really great. And I'm glad that it exists. It was just amazing. It was exciting, and it was brutal. It was funny. It was sad. All that stuff without one word being uttered. It's about a caveman and his dinosaur. That's it. And it is spectacularly awesome. Now, I know you're a fan.
Yeah, big fan of Primal and a big fan of Genndy Tartakovsky.
Yeah.
One of the hardest names to pronounce in animation. I mean, I've been watching his stuff all throughout growing up. Most of the cartoons that I watched as a kid were created by him and were his brain children. And
a lot of people would know Samurai Jack. That would be
Samurai Jack
was probably was that the biggest one?
Well, you've got stuff like the Powerpuff Girls. You've got stuff like Dexter's Laboratory and the Hotel Transylvania movies. Right. Many people didn't know that those were made by him.
Powerpuff Girls is one of my favorite things that's ever existed in the world. I love Powerpuff Girls. I love them. I've got the entire box set at home.
Wow.
All of it in a big, giant box. I love it. And I love Buttercup. Mojo Jojo. Mojo Jojo.
I like, my favorite villain was him, the guy with the lobster hands.
Man. Yeah, well, that was
just really weird.
That's just a really weird character.
Exactly.
Yeah. Like, I was thinking, all right.
But this guy's moved into different territory.
Yeah.
He's gone above and beyond.
Well, it's just this Primal. If you've got Cartoon Network, it's on Adult Swim. I don't even know what night it's on because it's on my DVR.
It's Sunday nights, I believe.
Sunday at like 11. I think it's. I know it's on late.
Yeah, it's in the late night block, and it's where it should be for the content.
Yeah,
and everything
for the content
like
of it because it's a little bloody.
Yeah, would not show it
intense.
To kids.
So it's so good though. If you've seen it, 312-981-7200. I want to talk a little bit more about this guy and his animation. Right after we take a break. And then coming up after the 1:30 news, Kitty Coran is going to join us. She's an illustrator and also the co-author of For Your Consideration, Keanu Reeves, which is a terrific book, a tribute to the one and only Keanu Reeves, a really fun one. Paperback, lots of great illustrations, lots of fun stuff in it, and quizzes and all kinds of cool stuff. So we'll get to that coming up in just a little bit after the 1:30 news.
Sometimes he'd get up, try to do his thing. He'd begin to move.
Yeah.
Something like this.
Gotta find a woman. Gotta find a woman. Gotta find a woman. Dance. Jimmy Castor, man. I had Jimmy Castor on my show. He was fantastic before he passed. Yeah. But we were like, you know, during the 2008 run that the Cubs were on. It's Nick DiGilio, by the way. We're back. On a Tuesday morning. Two for Tuesday. Get your request in now. You mean Two for Tuesday? So I don't know how this happened. I don't know why it happened, but when the Cubs would... Are you familiar with Bertha Butt Boogie?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Thanks to you, of course.
Yeah. Anyway, for some reason, Simon's was the, you know, the bar that I hung out at back in those days. And we would watch the Cubs games there, you know, during their postseason stretch in 2008. And the Best of Jimmy Castor was on the jukebox at Simon's. So it got played a lot. And we played Bertha Butt Boogie a lot. And Bertha Butt Boogie has this riff, you know, this repeated riff that goes bum, bum, ba-ba-dum, ba-dum, bum, bum, ba-ba-dum. And that's how it's exactly what it sounds. So every time the Cubs would score a run, for some reason, everybody at the bar, because it was played, the song was played so much in the bar, everybody at the bar, me and my friends, would just start going bum, bum, ba-ba-dum. And it became like the rallying theme for the 2008 Cubs. And so I had Jimmy Castor on during October of 2008 or late September of 2008. I had him on. And I told him that. He's like, that's crazy, man. Jimmy Castor. But see, the reason why you played that song is about a Neanderthal, which is what Primal is about. I still got that throat thing happening, man. So we're talking about Primal, and if you've not seen it, you should, because it's amazing. And if you have seen it, we'd love to hear from you at 312-981-7200. The 312 area code says, how did you feel about the Powerpuff Girls reboot? Didn't like it very much. Didn't have the same feeling that the original Powerpuff Girls did. But I adore Powerpuff Girls. I love them. Ugh. Okay, but now the football game from last night. So I guess there were some problems. 708 area code explaining what happened. It was primarily in the fourth quarter, two penalties in critical situations against the Lions. It was the same guy for grabbing a face mask, and it clearly was not. And it cost the Lions the game. Uh-oh.
Not good.
No. So. Now, so what? When did you first discover? Was it Samurai Jack? Was that the first one that you?
No, it was
Dexter.
Dexter's Lab. Yeah, I used to love it. It was really weird, really funny. A lot of people my age, if you say the words omelette du fromage, to them, they'll get the episode and all that kind of stuff. But Genndy Tartakovsky just is a really unique individual. I believe a Russian born, but came to the States. And he just had a really interesting sensibility about the humor and the way that he did his cartoons. They're always very strange, super influenced by genre stuff and sci-fi.
Yeah.
And he used it to great effect many times. But really, he came into his own with Samurai Jack, which was a little bit more... It was still for kids, ostensibly, but a little bit older. Like, teens could really enjoy it. Even adults could really enjoy it.
And that the animation style of Samurai Jack is primal... It's very much like Primal.
Very similar.
Very similar, because Powerpuff Girls is not, neither is Dexter. But this is kind of a and also kind of a stylistic companion piece to Samurai Jack.
Absolutely.
With some of the flourishes and the light and the color in the background and everything.
And the quiet as well. Really quiet moments. And the fact that he's doing this all without dialogue, I think, is really important.
That's the thing about this. That's the thing that really blew me away about Primal, is they don't speak in it. And the story is told beautifully and... you know, emotionally and thrillingly. Like, it's really exciting and kind of scary. And, you know, I think, and the characters look beautiful. I love the dinosaur and I love the caveman.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable how much storytelling can get done if you just focus on visuals. I think we've lost a little bit of that when folks go to, whether it's a movie or when you're watching TV, how much is really told to you through what you're seeing and why, and how much you can understand it if you give yourself the time, you give yourself the opportunity.
Yeah, I've always, you know, I've always loved that kind of stuff. You know, we were talking about great movie openings, movies with great opening scenes, and we mentioned There Will Be Blood. No dialogue in that opening. But anyway, if you've got cable and you got the Cartoon Network, watch Primal on Adult Swim. It's really, really great. So, okay, we got a break here. We got the news coming up, and then after the news, Kitty Coran, who's the co-author of For Your Consideration, Keanu Reeves, is going to join me right here in studio. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It is a Tuesday, so two for Tuesday. Get your request in now, 312-981-7200. We are going to talk about weird sports superstitions. Fleetwood Mac's Tusk album turned 40, if you can believe that. So we're going to talk about Fleetwood Mac as well. And movies that changed because of test screenings. That's happened quite a lot. So that's all coming up on the show. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text if you want to join us. And follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and to stay connected on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Okay, the reason why we played that is because we are about to talk to the co-author of a book called For Your Consideration, Keanu Reeves. Now, if you're a regular listener of the show, if you have been listening to me for the years that I've been on WGN, I have been a staunch supporter of Keanu. So when I got this book came across my desk, I was like, well, we have to talk about it on the air. And it's by Larissa. How do you pronounce her last name?
Zagaris.
Larissa Zagaris, who is under the weather and can't be here.
She is.
I think she has the bug that I had over the weekend.
Indeed. She's been stricken down.
And then Kitty Curran is here.
Yes.
And you co-wrote the book with
I did.
Well, first of all, I just, you know, as I just mentioned, I've been a fan of Keanu Reeves since it wasn't pop. Now he's in a renaissance now.
Right. And I think everyone's kind of rediscovered him.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's maybe more that the powers that be have rediscovered him. Mm-hmm. I think everyone's really had a real soft spot for him. The internet, I kind of feel, found him before Hollywood rediscovered him. And
yeah.
We're like, oh, yeah, this guy, he's awesome. Why did we stop working with him again?
It's been a strong couple of years for him. This year in particular, he had another John Wick movie. He was so funny in Toy Story 4.
He was amazing.
Just everybody seems to like Keanu now. And I was like, where you been? I've been a Keanu
Indeed.
Fan since River's Edge, since Youngblood.
You're from back in the day.
Yeah.
I was more of the coming of age when he was young and beautiful in the mid-90s.
Mm-hmm.
And have many, 12 and 13-year-old memories of Keanu all across the billboards in Little Buddha of that era.
Yeah.
And also, I'm half Chinese, half English, and I feel that most people who are half Asian, half white, and grew up in the 90s have a bit of a soft spot for Keanu. Because, it really was just him back in the day.
Yeah.
And so, it was kind of nice to have someone who's a bit like me on the screen, which I didn't maybe quite put two and two together at the time.
But I remember he used to get a bad rap all the time.
Right.
He was dumb. He was a bad actor.
Yeah.
And I never, ever felt that ever.
I think it was more that he was miscast in something. So that, I think he'll be the first to admit that Bram Stoker's Dracula's maybe not his finest hour.
No.
But, just because he was miscast doesn't mean that he can't be amazing.
Yeah.
And that, even back in the day, Bill and Ted would not be the same without him.
No.
Can you imagine it with a different one of those?
I can't, and I'm so excited about the new one.
I know.
It's so exciting.
I know.
Well, let's get to your background, first of all. Obviously, from your voice, we can tell that you are English.
Indeed. I am originally from London, specifically Wimbledon, and I came here because I married an American.
Oh,
so I was enticed over by man. So I've been here since 2011, basically.
And you are, not only did you co-write this, but you're an illustrator.
I am.
And you have illustrated other things with your partner.
Indeed.
And how did you get into that? When did that start for you?
Basically, I taught myself from copying Sailor Moon stills from the internet back in the 90s.
Uh-huh.
And there's a lot of references here.
Yeah.
And did it a lot as a kid. Did it for fun. Never really thought I was good enough to ever pursue it professionally. And then at a previous job that I worked at for a web design company, I just made a Christmas card for everyone that I illustrated with a cartoon of everyone. And the chief designer was like, can we use these for our website and our business cards? And that was kind of my first key into like, oh, maybe I could do this for real.
There you go.
there. And from then on, it's been an upward journey. I didn't actually illustrate this one. We got to have some input about what the illustrations were, which were fun. Mm-hmm. So it was a bit more like, ha-ha, dance for your queen, which was nice.
How did you meet Larissa?
I met Larissa through another writing partner. She was basically my first friend in Chicago after I arrived here having married my husband. I only actually meant to come out here for 6 months back in 2010 and then met my husband the second day there. Yeah. So, you know, things happened. And so I kind of had left, you know, most of my friends and the job I'd had before and was working this temp job at an insurance company that I was not enjoying much. And she was kind of my friend there who was fun and cool and also was writing and doing fun stuff. So we started writing together. And then
is the connection between you guys, is it really pop culture related?
Yeah, basically our real kind of joint partnership began after we were writing a webcomic that never got off the ground with two other girls. And then unfortunately, obviously, two other girls had to move away. One went to New York and the other went to Seattle. So we were kind of left on our own. Mm-hmm. And Larissa had been doing this a Tumblr called Taylor Swift Girl Detective that had got a huge following.
Yeah.
That was basically stills of Taylor Swift looking very much like Nancy Drew with a little caption of the crime that she was solving at the time. And I kind of, for fun, illustrated a cover for this hypothetical book in the series, and it really kind of took off to the extent we had a cosplayer go to a Taylor Swift fan went to a Taylor Swift concert dressed as the Taylor Swift from the Taylor Swift Girl Detective book cover.
That's amazing.
Yes. So basically we were like, oh, well, we should maybe actually make this book for real. And then I lost a job and she was going for a bad breakup and we were kind of sat being a bit depressed at her kitchen table and we were like, you know, this is the time. We are not going to let this evening go this way. We're going to make the book.
Mm-hmm.
Plotted it out that evening and the rest is history.
Why Taylor Swift?
Well, I think it was all started with kind of Larissa riffing with her sister about how much she looked like Nancy Drew and then kind of realizing there was legs in that. Yeah. But the monster.
By the way, have you seen the new Nancy Drew on the CW?
I haven't seen an episode yet, but it's on my to watch list because, you know, obviously.
Absolutely.
Girl detectives and mysteries have always been something I've been a fan
when
of.
When I was a kid, it was Pamela Sue Martin. She was Nancy Drew. They did back in the 70s. They did every other Sunday. On one Sunday, they would do the Hardy Boys, and then the following Sunday, they would do Nancy Drew, and they would alternate. Pamela Sue Martin was the actress who played Nancy Drew. I had a massive crush on her.
You see, we did not have that, but we did have like the edgy, updated Nancy Drew Case Files.
Yeah.
In the 80s, kind of like covers that they were still going in the 90s, were kind of dated, but we still kind of, you know, read them because they were the slightly, you know, alluded to, you know, maybe people dying, but not really.
That's great. So that Taylor Swift thing took off.
Yep. We kickstarted the book and got a huge amount of coverage that we were not expecting, including from Time Magazine, which was deeply surreal.
Yeah.
Off the back of that, we had a whole bunch of people follow us on social media. One of them was our future editor, and then we got our first publishing deal, basically, from that.
So where did the Keanu book come from?
So the Keanu book is our second book with Quirk. Our first one was My Lady's Choosing, which was a choose-your-own-adventure romance novel. The Keanu Reeves book came from Larissa was riffing with our editor on Twitter just in the comments of someone else talking about Keanu Reeves, about how much they love him, and they basically realized there was a mutual love. Because basically everyone loves Keanu Reeves, and I kind of feel it was, you know, I don't think people forgot him. I think the media forgot him. I think Hollywood forgot him.
Yeah.
But the people did not.
Yeah.
And certainly,
he was always on my radar.
Right. And certainly Larissa and Ajanti did not forget him. And so they started talking, and it basically became this whole idea of kind of re-examining pop culture icons.
Yeah.
So there's also a companion book in this for Dwayne the Rock Johnson.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So it's also amazing.
Well,
so should, and also out tomorrow.
Let me just say, that this book is so fantastically entertaining. And as a fan of Keanu, I ripped through this thing.
Oh, thank you.
And I really love it. I love the illustrations. I love the quiz that's in there, and I love the way it's set up and everything. But let's talk a little bit more about it. We got to take a break, okay?
Cool.
We're going to take a break here. Kitty Curran is with us. She is the co-author of a book called For Your Consideration, Keanu Reeves, which comes out today.
Yep.
All right.
Today.
Jumping right on top
of
it.
That's right.
All right. We'll break, and we'll come back with more on 720 WGN. Yeah, one of the greatest final scenes in movie history. welcome back, everybody. My guest is Kitty Curran. She's an illustrator and an author, and she is the co-writer of a terrific book called For Your Consideration, Keanu Reeves. And it's all about love for Keanu.
Indeed.
And that, of course, is from the final moments of The Matrix. We were just discussing this off the air.
Indeed. And how it still holds up.
Yeah.
One of the best things about this book is I had to rewatch all of Keanu's back catalog for that. So, The Matrix.
It celebrated its 20th anniversary this year, and they re-released it in the movie theaters and the Dolby cinemas around the country. And I went, and it's one of my favorite movies.
Yeah.
And it was truly one of the best film experiences I've had all year. Mm-hmm. And the movie's 20 years old.
Yeah.
So
I was 16 when it came out, and I remember discussing about how amazing it was with my high school boyfriend.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Yeah. It's just a great movie.
Yeah.
Well, let's go through some of your favorites. Let's talk a little bit about some of your favorite Keanu movies and moments. You've got so many. This is such a cleverly constructed book, and it's so much fun to read, and how you've listed these things out and the facts about Keanu. Well, you said researching. How much research did you guys do for this?
A lot. Bless the internet and the Keanu fandom. You know, the Keanu being awesome subreddit and of their main fan site, which I spent so many times on, and I cannot remember the name off the top of my head.
Oh, okay.
But it's, really reading up on all of that stuff.
Yeah.
There's just so much. There is just so much. And he's such a personable person that there is so much of him interacting with the fans randomly.
Yeah.
So you have photos of him randomly from the 90s, maybe even the late 80s, early Keanu, where a couple of fans literally hopped his fence and he was just like, okay, and had a beer with them. And you can see these photos on the internet.
That's one of the things about Keanu that he's got. He's got this incredible reputation of being like so connected to his fans. What was the bit that the thing that he did a few months back where there was a sign on the lawn front, somebody's front lawn that says, you're beautiful too. And then he took the sign down and wrote, you're beautiful as well, signed it.
Oh, I did not see that. I did see the Your Breathtaking moment.
Your Breathtaking,
I was at the Games Conference. He described something as breathtaking, and someone yelled out, you're breathtaking. And then Keanu was like, no, you're breathtaking.
Yeah.
And another meme was born because Keanu is a meme machine.
He is. Sad Keanu on the bench.
Yes. It's been going on for nearly a decade now.
Yeah.
Sad Keanu is 2010.
Yeah.
So it really... He's ongoing every year.
The other thing about it is, and you guys point this out, interviewing people and quoting people who have worked with him on movies, widely considered to be one of the most generous and one of the nicest and most personable people that you could ever work with in Hollywood.
Yeah.
He gives up his salary. He gives to charity, a lot of money to charity.
Yes.
He's an incredible guy.
He is. And again, that's one of the things you can kind of see on the internet is kind of like... and we do cover this in the book, is that, you know, the sort of fan stories or, you know, people who worked with him on the set, just the random guys who, you know, happen, you know, to just be on the crew, can pass these stories around on the internet. So we kind of know a lot more about, Keanu than we would have done. And I think maybe that's a large part of it is, you know, part of the mythos was created not by publicists, but by people just talking about how great he is.
Well, this is a one-stop shop right here in the, this book. It's all here. It's for your consideration. Keanu Reeves, brand new book out today, released today. Do you have a favorite Keanu movie?
That's a very, very tough choice. You know, it's like picking a favorite parent, really. I would have to say, just for nostalgia, I have very fond memories of watching Bill and Ted, both one and two, with my family. At the same time, maybe John Wick still wins.
Yeah.
Maybe. Or maybe The Matrix wins. It's very hard.
My favorite is Point Break.
Oh.
I love that movie. I've seen it 8 million times. Catherine Bigelow is one of my favorite directors of all time.
I'm now extra conflicted. I forgot. Yeah. I can't believe it.
You know, 91 was an incredible year for him, and you guys have a listing of all his movies.
We
In 91, he did Bogus Journey, which I like more than the first one.
Really?
I do. I think it's because of Bill Sadler's death, because he's so funny. And
I do.
All the games that they're playing, the football game that they're playing with death and everything, funny.
And also the references in that. I don't understand how I found it funny as a child. And now watch it as an adult.
Not a big Bergman fan?
Yeah, no. And now I'm like, oh, okay. Apparently I was getting something from this.
Because in 91, there was that. There was Point Break and My Own Private Idaho all in one year.
Oh, man.
That's a strong year.
That's a very strong year.
Yeah. I love him in a lot of, you know, it's the, you know, which, there's a small independent movie that he did called Thumbsucker.
Yes.
He's so good in that movie.
He's like this hippie dentist, which for you know, everyone but the two people in the world apparently watch this movie. And he's amazing. And I can't believe I've met another person who's seen
it. Oh, I love that movie. I love it.
But I also randomly saw it before I researched this book, like, seriously, a decade ago when it came out. And weirdly, Keanu specifically stuck with me in that movie above everything else. I really barely remember much else about that movie.
I remember liking the movie but loving him.
Yes. Pretty much.
And I also really liked him. You see, these are kind of a little bit offbeat roles. He's done some, you know, obviously some low budget movies and some art house movies. But he was in, I can't remember the name of the movie now, but he was great in the Diane Keaton, Jack Nicholson.
Something's Gotta Give.
Yeah, he's great
in
that.
He's amazing in it.
Yeah.
And also, again, one of the many times I've been like, oh, come on, you'd have clearly picked Keanu.
Yeah.
You'd have clearly picked Keanu.
Yeah.
Again, with Dracula. No. Mina married Keanu for a reason.
Yeah. Well, this is really, I mean, it's great. Now, let's talk a little bit about, you didn't do the illustrations for this book.
I did not.
But talk about your illustrations. What are some of your, who are some of the illustrators that have inspired you or that you're fans of?
I have basically kind of do a lot of riffing of the illustrations in the books I used to glum as a kid. So Taylor Swift Girl Detective is very much done in the style of the old school Nancy Drew books. I've been going through a little pulp kind of horror phase, and also kind of the 80s Point Break kind of look I've been playing with. Yeah. So basically kind of riffing on older styles, but with visual puns. So dad jokes in visual form.
Do you try to draw something every day? Do you try to work every day?
I actually have unfortunately fallen off the drawing wagon as much as I'd like to, just because a lot of the writing work's picked up. Another thing Larissa and I are working on but we can't talk about is another one where we'll be writing but I won't be illustrating.
Okay.
There is a comic right now I'm working on that Larissa and I also wrote that's coming out next year, will be kickstarted next year, that is run by a cartoonist for The Nib, For the 100th anniversary of women getting the vote.
Oh, nice.
So we're doing a kind of making a comic about Susan B. Anthony's legacy, but in a fun way, educational.
That's great. That's great. Well, that's really sounds like it's a lot of fun. So do you like the writing part now? Because you were an illustrator, but now you've segued into writing. How does that work for you?
I always really liked doing both. As a kid, I kind of, was the only kid I know who wanted to make comics, so that basically meant I had to wear both hats. So I learned doing both, and as I got older, at certain points in my life, I've been lucky enough to get paid to do the art, and other times been lucky enough to get paid to do the writing, and I will take whichever I get.
Well, you're good at it. I can tell you that, and I really enjoy the book. For your consideration, Keanu Reeves. Where did the quiz to determine which Keanu John come from?
I can't remember which fever dream that came from. We were very sleep deprived at certain points in this book, so it kind of, certain ideas have blended together. There are certain essays we know who wrote what, but the quizzes, I feel, I have no idea, quite frankly.
But he's played a character named John in several movies.
Yeah, I think we were discussing how he's played the everyman so much, and then how he has such bland names like Thomas Anderson, and then realized how many of them are all called John. Yeah. And I think that's really where it came from.
Yeah, well, it's fun. There's so much fun stuff. You talk about some of his frequent collaborators. Mm-hmm. That's in there too. The couple of movies he's made with Sandra Bullock and Charlize Theron. Mm-hmm. And Winona Ryder. It covers everything. Yes. I mean, if you're a Keanu Reeves fan, you have to buy this book. It's really, really terrific. And I'm a huge Keanu Reeves fan, and I love the book. Oh. It's for your consideration, Keanu Reeves, Larissa Zagaris?
Zagaris.
God,
it took me about a year,
Zagaris.
So don't worry.
And my guest is Kitty Curran. And the book is out today. So make sure you pick it up. It's really terrific. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
The book is great. It was delightful to talk to you.
Lovely to talk to you too.
Okay, we'll take a quick break. It's Nick DiGilio. The news is coming up next.
Heading out this morning into the sun. Riding on the diamond waves, little darling.
Right. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here in downtown Chicago till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich in the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It is Tuesday, 2 for Tuesday. Yeah, man, 2 for Tuesday. You can get your requests in. It's one artist, two songs, 312-981-7200. Who requested The Heart?
That's coming to us from Steve.
All right, Steve. There you go. Welcome back, everybody. So we were just talking about Keanu, and I guess people were contacting you and saying, hey, I'm buying the book.
Yeah.
So we sold a few books.
Yeah, I hope so.
That's great. That's great. It's a terrific book. It really is.
Lovely.
But 319 area code says, still my favorite Keanu line and scene is from the original Parenthood, where he says, is that Grandma? Grandma, you got short. And Grandma says, I'm shrinking. And Larry says, bummer. There it is. Keanu. Yeah. We didn't even mention Devil's Advocate. I mentioned Charlize Theron, but we didn't mention Devil's Advocate.
Are you a fan of Big Mouth, the show Big Mouth?
Yes.
Have you watched season 3?
No.
There's a Devil's Advocate joke.
Is there?
Yes. Yeah, really funny and really kind of dumb, but there is one.
Okay. All right. Yeah, and there's a performance, and another non-subtle performance from Pacino. Like, the last 15 minutes of that movie, he's just screaming. So, but he's playing the devil, so I give him a pass on that. Keanu does a lot of screaming in that movie, so does, and Charlize Theron does a lot of, really crying and having a breakdown throughout the entire movie.
It's a wild flick.
Yeah. Taylor Hackford. Yes. Husband of Helen Mirren. So, yeah, Taylor Hackford's directed some great movies and some bad movies, but a lot of great ones, like Officer and Gentleman he directed, which is great. He did the Chuck Berry documentary, Hey Hail Rock and Roll documentary slash concert movie. Also great. So, oh, he also directed Against All Odds with my main man Jeff Bridges and James Woods and Rachel Ward.
You know, what's really funny is that he's, you know, done a lot of stuff. He's had his own career. And yet, on some level, he's probably still referred to as Helen Mirren's husband.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Your wife's more famous than you, man.
Yeah.
I'm sure he's cool with it.
You know, he's made movies that have been nominated for Oscars and stuff like that. But, yeah,
but
no,
is
I
he
mean,
the queen?
It's, you know, it's Helen Mirren, man. You're married to a dame. So. All right. So a lot of athletes, whether they're professional or amateur or whatever, they do have these weird sort of rituals and superstitions that they have. And I know that there a lot of people have weird rituals and superstitions in many different careers and jobs and stuff. And we've talked about the ridiculous theater superstitions that anybody who's ever done theater knows that there are a lot of weird superstitions and rituals that actors and people in the theater, tech people, stage managers go through just because they've been around for, you know, so many years. But sports, I think, do you think sports has the most? Wouldn't you say sports? I mean, theater's way up there, but wouldn't you say sports is pretty high?
It's pretty high, and I think it has some of the most extreme.
Yeah.
Because it's dealing with, you know, obviously actors give physical performances, but we're talking about people who need to be at the top of their game.
Yeah.
And it's not just the physical, but also the mental. So they will do the strangest stuff if it really makes them believe that they're going to perform best.
Yeah. And that's what we're going to talk about. These very, very out there weird superstitions and rituals in sports. A lot of these are pro sports, so you've probably heard about them. And if you guys have any that you would like to share or comment on, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Now, one of the stories that got us to talk about this is a current story right now involving the LA Kings, the NHL team out of Los Angeles. And here's the story. They think Taylor Swift is a jinx. So Taylor Swift's reputation had this whole thing where the old nice Taylor was killed off by new mean Taylor, and her follow-up lover is fully back on the nice train. It seems like the mean version of Taylor Swift is still out there doing mean Taylor Swift stuff. Weirdly, the mean stuff this time around involves screwing things up for the Los Angeles Kings hockey team and not, like, breaking the hearts of nice guys or whatever. But this is still clearly the work of mean Taylor Swift, well, supposedly. This comes from Deadline, which says the Kings have fully embraced a trend of fan-led superstition by agreeing to cover up a banner at the Staples Center honoring Swift's 16th and sold-out concert at the venue after somehow coming to the conclusion that the banner was to blame for the team's ugly losing streak. The Kings won the Cup in 2012 and 2014, but their fortunes have declined so much since then. The Deadline says the team has the second-worst record in the entire NHL last season after what was going to assume would be a somewhat tongue-in-cheek fan campaign. The Kings have decided to cover up the banner whenever they play at home at the Staples Center this season. And as pointed out by the official Twitter account of Kings mascot Bailey, they are now undefeated in home games since banishing the dark spirit of Taylor Swift. What does Bailey look like? I'm gonna look for Bailey. Because you know how much I like the mascots. Let's just see here. Bailey? Okay. Oh, is he a wolf man? What? Is he a lion? I don't understand. He looks like a wolf man or maybe a lion of some kind. I'm not quite sure I understand what the connection is with Kings. Oh, the King of the Jungle? That's probably what it is. He's a weird looking. Have you seen Bailey, the LA Kings mascot?
Yeah, he's got a great mane.
He's weird looking. And he looks angry. He looks like a very angry mascot. Like he's going to kill you.
Well, I mean, he is a lion.
But he's going to kill everyone.
It's better than putting a real lion on the ice.
Well, it's nice to know that Bailey does have a Twitter account. So you can follow Bailey before he kills you. You can follow him on Twitter and find out when he's going to kill you. I guess that's what you'll learn from Bailey, the LA Kings mascot. So anyway, so they say that they cover up this banner of Taylor Swift, and they are now undefeated in home games since banishing the dark spirit of Taylor Swift. Of course, that itself is a joke since the team has only played one game at home this season. But we're not about to try to introduce actual facts to sports superstitions. Interestingly, as pointed out by the LA Times, the Los Angeles Clippers also cover up Swift's banner. Though that probably has more to do with the fact that it's located near some Lakers banners than anything to do with Taylor Swift. And covering it up hasn't done anything to help their record anyway. Well, what else happens in the Staples Center? Right? Well, wait, the Clippers don't play at the Staples Center, do they?
Oh, my God. I haven't followed the Clippers in a long time, much less the
Lakers
NBA.
The Lakers play at the Staples Center, right? Or do they both play there?
Yeah, so Lakers, Clippers, Kings, and the Los Angeles Sparks, which are...
What team? What sport is that?
Looks like it was basketball.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, it's WNBA.
Teams. Oh, WNBA. Yeah. Okay. All right. So the Clippers and the Lakers play in the same stadium. Okay. So they've been it doesn't say the Lakers have been covering up Taylor Swift's face.
Just the Kings.
So that's the only time. No, the Kings and the Clippers.
Kings and the Clippers. Okay.
So that's the only time that you can see Taylor Swift's face is if you go to a Lakers game. Otherwise, they cover it up. When is her 16th concert? I mean, is her sold-out concert? Because that's what the banner is advertising. Once that thing passes, they don't have to worry about it anymore, right? Once the concert passes, they're not going to have to climb up there and cover up Taylor Swift's face in order to win games. Because the banner's probably going to be taken down. You're not going to advertise something that already happened. You know? All right. So, The LA Kings have completely embraced this. Taylor Swift is a jinx, so they're covering up her face. Because she's on a cursed banner. That story is pretty funny. All right. Now, there's an interesting explanation for this article about the weirdest superstitions and rituals in sports, which is what we're talking about. If you guys want to jump in here with ones that you know, weird rituals, weird superstitions in sports. 312-981-7200. There are a few spheres of life that inspire us to cling to strange superstitions and rituals more than sports. Perhaps it's because sports like basketball, football, hockey, etc., straddle an excruciating line where the outcome of a game is dictated by much by fortune as it is by plays. But these superstitions aren't all excruciating rituals involving wearing the same ragged t-shirt that you wore a decade ago that made your team to the playoffs, or some unique celebrations rooted in the team's legend. Superstitions and rituals are often as interwoven into the team's or athlete's identity as the biggest wins and losses from the past era. And it's not just the fans who get compelled by their ancient lizard brains to do things that we all know are silly. Athletes sometimes have even more bizarre superstitions than the fans. And here are some of the weirdest superstitions and rituals in sports. Why don't we break? And we will. Is that all we got right here? Wow, okay. All right, we'll take a quick break. When we come back, we've got weirdest superstitions and rituals in sports, and we want to hear from you at 312-981-7200.
There I was with the old man, stranded again, so off I'd ran. The young world crashing around me, no possibilities of getting what I need. He looked at me and smiled.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. Yeah, we're back. It's Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the Skyline studio here, as we are every weekday morning, here until 5 a.m. Opening bell at 5, Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It's Tuesday, 2 for Tuesday. Yippee, 2 for Tuesday! And we're continuing at that. Get your requests in now, 312-981-7200. One artist, two songs, 312-981-7200. All right. A lot of people have weird superstitions and rituals, and a lot of them center around sports with athletes, even fans. I was telling the story yesterday morning about when we were watching some Hawks playoff games at my friend's house. There was about seven or eight of us there watching, and this was during the 2010 Cup run, and the Hawks were down. One of the people who was there went into the bathroom, and when he went to the bathroom, the Hawks scored. So we made him stay in the bathroom. We said, you can't leave the bathroom because the Hawks scored while you were in the bathroom. So that means you have to stay in the bathroom. There was a TV in the bathroom, but he did stay in the bathroom. He listened to us. He was outnumbered. He was outnumbered by a bunch of idiots who thought it meant something that our friend was in the bathroom and that the Hawks scored. But everybody was, like, sitting in the same chair that they were sitting in during the game, you know, the last game when the Hawks won. Some people were standing, and they stood, like, most of the game in whatever corner they were. We were drinking the same, like, booze that we were drinking. We wanted everything to be exactly the same because they won the last game. So we made this dude stay in the bathroom. So that's weird. But I think the players go even further with some of their stuff. And that's what we're talking about. Rituals in sports. Here we go. Mike Bibby clips fingernails during timeouts. What? During his NBA career, point guard Mike Bibby's nervous habit of biting his nails took on a life of its own. He was often spotted on the bench furiously gnawing on his nails, obsessively picking at them, and making everyone around him nervous in the process. Eventually, he figured out a way to streamline the picking and center himself via the use of nail clippers. It got to the point where every time Bibby parked his butt on the bench, someone would hand him a set of nail clippers so that he could immediately get down to the other business at hand, addressing his cuticle situation. That's nuts. That's nuts. I did not know that. That's just really weird.
At least he's clipping and not, you know, picking or biting. Because I know some people can really get bothered by the biting.
Yeah. Yeah, but clipping your fingernails in public is... I just don't, you know... That's like people who clip their fingernails on the CTA. You know? People take their shoes off and start clipping their toenails on the CTA. Like, what are you doing? But yeah, I never knew that. Mike Bibby, NBA center... at point guard, clipped his fingernails during timeouts. That is crazy. That's just the first one of many here that we have. I think it's going to get weirder. 708 area code says Michael Jordan wore college shorts in the pros. He thought it was all the luck that he had the North Carolina shorts on under his pro shorts. Yeah, I remember that one. It was every game. Every game he wore the North Carolina shorts under his shorts, Michael Jordan. It must have did some good, considering how good Michael Jordan is.
No wonder Space Jam was such a good movie.
Oh, God. You were a kid, right, when you saw it?
Yeah, and are you kidding me? I worshipped Michael Jordan. But I actually, you know what I was a really big fan of? It was Dennis Rodman.
Oh, God.
I actually met him on a plane.
You met Dennis Rodman on a plane?
Yeah, when I was a kid.
Was he wearing a wedding dress?
Oh, God, maybe. No, I was pretty small. I was maybe like 5 years old.
Do you love Double Team?
Well, yeah.
With him and Van Damme?
Of course.
Okay.
But I thought he was wild. I was just like, hey, Mom, he's got crazy hair.
I can't stand that guy.
Listen, he's solving the world's problems one visit at a time.
Yeah. No, I always hated it. I always hated Dennis Rodman, especially when he was on the Pistons.
Come
I mean,
on
when
with
he
the
when
bad
he,
boys
when he came to the no.
I have a professional respect for the bad boys.
Don't say that.
It's true. I'm not going to lie. Bill Laimbeer playing a little
jackass.
Yeah, but he invented combat basketball.
Oh, no. Don't talk to me about those guys because they were the bane of my existence when I was a basketball fan. I stopped being a basketball fan in the early 90s, like right before the Bulls
the run,
went on their
yeah.
stretch. Like 91 for me was like the biggest year. You know why? I mean, they won the championship that year. But that's not the reason why. It's because they swept the damn Pistons. That's why, in the playoffs. That's why. Every single year, the Pistons would beat the Bulls. Every year in the playoffs. And they were jerks. They would just slap Isaiah Thomas right across the face. I mean, Bill Laimbeer. Get out of here with Bill Laimbeer. I can't believe you like the Detroit Pistons bad boys era. Are you nuts? Are you nuts?
Maybe a little.
Oh, my God.
Combat basketball, baby.
Oh. And then when they got swept, when the Bulls swept them in 91, everybody walked off the court, did not shake hands except for John Sally. I remember that specifically because I was jumping up and down like a lunatic in my living room. I used to be a massive basketball fan. Like in the 80s and up to the early 90s, 70s, 80s, and early 90s, I was a massive Bulls fan. I don't know what it was. When they started winning, I stopped watching. I have no idea, and I haven't gone back to basketball at all. But it was that weird period, 70s, 80s, 90s, early 90s, especially the 80s. Especially the 80s, from like when they got Jordan through. And every single year, did I hate those guys. Bad boys. Okay, we got a break. We've got a lot of weird, crazy, strange superstitions and rituals to talk about that involve sports, and we want to hear from you guys at 312-981-7200. All right, the news is coming up right after this.
The second hand unwind. If you're lost, you can look and you will find me. Time after time. If you fall, I will catch you. I'll be waiting.
Right. Welcome back, everybody. Well, our first two sets of Two for Tuesdays feature two of the greatest voices ever. Pretty good. Two for Tuesday. Yeah, man, Two for Tuesday. One artist, two songs. Who requested the Cyndi Lauper?
It's coming to us from the 773.
All right. Good choice. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Skyline Studio here till 5 a.m. And we are talking about weird sports rituals and superstitions that people have. Fleetwood Mac's Tusk turned 40 a couple of days ago. So we're going to talk about that album and Fleetwood Mac in general and some other music stuff. Hey, before we get back to it, you know whose birthday it is today?
Trying to think. Oh, I know. McNulty.
That's right. McNulty.
Yeah. I saw that earlier.
McNulty turns 50. Of course, his real name is Dominic West, but he's always going to be McNulty. I can't believe I'm 4 years older than McNulty. Now, you want to feel real old? Well, I'll feel real old.
I'll feel normal.
By proxy, you'll feel. Tanya Roberts is 64.
Really?
Yeah. 64. We're going back to 70s and 80s, early 80s sex symbol right there. Featured beautifully in John Coscarelli's Beastmaster. So, all right. Welcome back, everybody. We are talking about weird superstitions and rituals for sports. And we've got some people on the line, and we want to hear from you, talk or text. What are the ones that you remember? 312-981-7200. Here's Steve on WGN. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, I don't know if you remember him. It was like late 90s. Do you remember Turk Wendell?
He was nuts.
Oh, okay. You remember him then.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It was one of the strangest behavior I've ever seen on a baseball field.
Oh, the black licorice, brushing his teeth between innings.
Yep.
Hopping over the third baseline.
Right, hopping over the third baseline, wouldn't step on the chalk.
Yeah,
he's in this article. Here's what they say about him, Steve.
Oh.
Pitchers are a strange breed, and it doesn't get much stranger than retired pitcher and noted weirdo Turk Wendell. According to the Wall Street Journal, Wendell had no shortage of superstitions, quirks, and rituals. His most recognizable identifier is the necklace he wore, which was made from the teeth of other various body parts of animals that he had hunted. Wendell was known to draw three crosses in the dirt on the mound before pitching and insisted numbers in his contract end in 99, which is his jersey number. He would also eat four pieces of licorice during games that he pitched and would brush his teeth in the dugout between innings, but not only after taking a flying leap over the baseline. So yeah, he was he had some serious OCD stuff going on, and yeah, I totally remember him. I totally remember Turk Wendell. Yeah.
Okay, well, he's the first one to jump to my head.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Steve, thanks, man.
Yeah, thanks,
Turk Wendell. Is he also the guy that no, it wasn't. Was it Turk Wendell? Was he also the guy that when he slid into first base, he got a hit and he slid into first base and he had dirt all over him, so he took his pants down at first base. He's like at first base. He's at first base and he takes down his pants and then finally realizes, oh wait, I'm in public. Like, I'm on a baseball field in front of thousands of people on national television and I just took my pants down to get the dirt out of them. I think that was Turk Wendell, because it kind of fits in with the other weird behaviors that guy had. But I specifically remember a guy like dived into first, dirt all over him. He just got up, stood up, took his pants down. And I was like, what do you do?
Weird guy. Very weird guy.
Yeah. I think it was the same guy. Somebody can confirm that whoever, maybe, or tell me if it wasn't him, who was it that got to first base and dropped Trout? Because it was ridiculous.
It was Steve Lyons.
Oh, Steve Lyons. Right.
We're getting a couple texts in from 708 and 847, so thank you, guys.
Right, Steve Lyons. Thank you, guys. Yeah, Steve Lyons. That's right. Took his pants down. Steve Lyons. That's right. All right. Let's see. Here's Rich on WGN. Hi, Rich.
Hi. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning.
I surely can't compete with Turk Lyons there, but when I was in high school, I was a gymnast for all 4 years of my high school, and every day of a meet, the night that we had the meet all day long in school, I would not step on the cracks of any tiles on the floor.
Wow.
All day long. Yeah. And I very conscious effort to do that. All 4 years I did that.
So you did that for 4 years to do well. Yep. As a gymnast, and also to not break your mother's back.
Yeah. Something
so
like
that's
that.
Another one. All right, Rich. Thanks.
Yep.
You know, this isn't a weird superstition or a ritual, but I always, you always found wrestlers in high schools to be nuts.
In more ways than one.
Because I mean, like regular, not pro wrestlers. I'm talking about wrestlers.
Yeah, like wrestlers
on the
wrestling
team.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
So, one, here's what I remember about wrestlers. They always had to make weight. So they wouldn't eat, and they would walk around. I knew like guys who would walk around with a cup and spit in it to lose weight, like to lose water weight. They would spit. They would walk around with a cup all day, 2-3 days in a row before a meet, and spit in the cup. And I was like, what the hell is wrong with you? You know?
That's the sport, man.
You go know? To the bathroom, pee if they don't have to.
Yeah, anything.
You know?
They do anything.
Go, and it was nuts, man. I mean, these guys were nuts. Not all of them. I don't want to make a blanket statement, but there were a few guys at Luther North when I went to high school who were like, what are you doing? But I always thought the walking around with a cup full of spit was weird. Got to make weight, man. Got to make weight. What are you doing?
Scary. Scary dudes.
Yeah, I just thought that was really strange.
Couldn't hear a thing, though. Most of them were deaf because of the cotton, cauliflower ear.
Cauliflower ear.
Horrible.
All right, how about this? There's nothing scarier than a large man who actually gains strength by being beaten on. That's exactly what forever Jaguars defensive tackle John Henderson is. He's 6'7". He's upwards around 350 pounds. Henderson could be described as nothing short of a monster. And this monster had a very particular way of getting psyched up for a game. Henderson would have a Jags assistant trainer straight up bitch slap him across the face as hard as humanly possible. I guess that if someone that big demands that you smack him across the face, there's nothing you can do but smack him across the face. But my first reaction when someone hits me is to freak out and hit him back. I wonder if that trainer was ever afraid Henderson would give him one back at some point. I want you to hit me as hard as you can. That's what he would say. Yeah, you know, those big football players, man, those guys are nuts. Some of them are nuts.
I will say I used to do that to psych myself up for if I had to perform, like, when I was on improv team or
what?
If I had to be in a play. Well, not as hard as I can. I'd, like, you know, you kind of get pumped up, try to, like, just get ready, get intense.
For improv?
Yeah, it's a comic sport.
Like,
come on, like, now, come on.
For improv? Really?
Well, I mean, as I've mentioned in the past, they always expected me to do, like, the pratfalls and stuff. They were just like, Tom can handle it. He's got to do the physical comedy. So I had to kind of beat myself up, get ready, get loose.
I did improv for a long time, man, and I never slapped or beat myself up before a set or a play. Slapping yourself around for improv?
Yeah.
Wow,
gets
man.
Gets the blood pumping.
Oh, you're out of your mind.
I understand this, man. I understand him.
You're out of your mind. How about this? Les Miles goes GOAT. LSU coach Les Miles is one of the most colorful characters in all of sports. With his lively press conferences and friendly disposition, he's kind of the anti-Nick Saban. Seriously, try to picture Nick Saban munching on grass he picked from the football field during a pregame activity. It's much easier to picture Les Miles munching on grass he's picked from the football field to a pregame activities because we've actually seen him do it. Miles said his pregame ritual humbles him as a man and, quote, it lets him know that he's part of the field and part of the game. Want to know which grass tastes best? Well, it's the grass in Tiger Stadium, duh. Of course, they say that. He may be a little crazy, but he's certainly not stupid. Eating grass. How about this one? Chucking octopi and rats. Oh, welcome to hockey. Welcome to hockey, everybody. You ever gone to a game in Detroit?
I have not had the pleasure, no.
I've been there. I've been there a few times when octopi fly. It's pretty cool. I've not gone to Florida to see the rat thing. At most sporting events, throwing objects onto the field of play is a practice sparked by bad officiating and other perceived grievances. However, when it comes to hockey, throwing stuff on the ice is a celebrated spectacle reserved for special moments. While the tradition of tossing hats on the ice after a hat trick is shared by all teams, the Red Wings and the Panthers have their own unique rituals tied to specific people and events. I hate the Red Wings more than, you know, I hate the Red Wings so much. Besides the Cardinals, I think my most hated team. Except the Hawks don't play them as much as they used to, so the rivalry's not as much fun. So they've been replaced by the Blues. But I love the octopus thing. I love it. I absolutely love it.
So people have to go out and buy.
they will purchase octopus for the game. So, as horrifying as the idea of octopus carcasses raining down from the stands at an arena sounds, it's one of the most recognizable NHL traditions, the legend of the octopus. Started when a Red Wings fan threw one of the critters onto the ice during a playoff game in 1952. It represented the 8 wins needed to secure Stanley Cup during the Stanley Cup era. You needed 8 wins, and, you know, an octopus has 8 legs, hence the first part of the name. After the incident, the Red Wings swept the playoffs, and the ice crew at Joe Louis Arena has been dealing with this mess ever since. It's fantastic.
I just, I imagine, how does everybody do it? Is it a select few?
It's not like a hat trick. When a hat trick happens, people sacrifice their hats.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you'll see hats fly all over the place, especially if somebody gets a hat trick on a giveaway night where they gave away hats.
Yeah. Oh,
that's when you're going to see like every hat thrown onto the ice. But it's not like there's 1,000 of them. You know, you get a few, but they do throw octopi out on the ice in Detroit.
What a waste of good octopi!
Florida Panthers, the rat trick started in 1995-1996 season when Panther winger Scott Mellenby killed a rat in the locker room before the home opener and then scored 2 goals later in the game. Why is there a rat in the locker room? Seriously? You're going to admit that your locker room at a professional sports team has a rat running around in it? The team went all the way to the Stanley Cup Finals. that year, losing to the Colorado Avalanche, the legend snowballed into the tradition of throwing plastic rats onto the ice after every score every goal scored by the Panthers. The rat trick grew into such a ridiculous act of fan-fueled mayhem that the NHL made the franchise stop selling toy rats at the arena, along with the threat of a delay of game penalty. Well, that's a bit much. After every goal? That's a bit much. They don't do that.
Need something more special.
They don't do that. They don't do that anymore. But can you imagine that after every goal? Because it takes 9 hours. You know, when there's a hat trick, it takes the ice crew like a bunch of minutes to clean up that ice.
Sure.
So let's say the Panthers score 6 goals in a game. 6 times you're going to have to go out and clean up rats off the ice. So, and they're working there, and they're selling fake rats at the stadium. All right. Let's take a break here. When we come back, we got more very strange, very weird superstitions and rituals that are tagged to sports. 312-981-7200. See your truth. Hi, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And how's it going? We're live in the Skyline studio here, downtown Chicago, here till 5 a.m. Fleetwood Mac's album Tusk turned 40 a few days ago, so we're going to talk about that album, Fleetwood Mac, and some test-screened movies we'll get to. But right now, we're having some fun talking about some ridiculous and very strange and weird superstitions and rituals that are associated with sports. Oh, there's my pumpkin. The Kit Kat pumpkin. That commercial is on all the time. And I think the girl's adorable with her little kitten ears. I'm sorry what I did to your face. All good. Have a break. I don't know why. I seriously don't know why I love that commercial so much. I laugh every time it comes on. Even when it sounds down, I laugh. Hey, the news is next, coming up in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. So we're talking about these weird superstitions and rituals. And by the way, what's the show? Irrational Pranksters? What the hell's the name of that?
Oh, Impractical Jokers.
Right. Irrational Pranksters.
That's the spit. It's like the Chinese version.
That's a sequel. Irrational Pranksters. Anyway, that show was just on, which it's on like, you know, now every weekday morning at like 2:30 or whatever. And so I was looking up at it, and one of the guys was wearing a t-shirt that said, "Looking good, Billy Ray. Feeling good, Lewis. From Trading Places." I've never seen that t-shirt before. "Looking good, Billy Ray. Feeling good, Lewis. From the end of Trading Places." That's pretty good. I think I might get that shirt. All right. We got some more texts coming in and a lot more weird sports-related rituals and superstitions. Good morning, guys. This is Trucker Rich. Hi, Rich. Didn't I hear on the news that at some sporting news that Joe Madden had his Oakland Athletics baseball hat underneath his jersey, underneath his shirt for the full World Series run? I don't know. I don't know about that. Jay says, "Hey, Nick, I think Sammy Sosa, the Chicago Cubs, walked into the dugout with a cup of coffee, then proceeded to bless the bat rack with three separate movements." Yeah, he was a weird dude, Sammy Sosa. He had some of these. He had some of those weird rituals. And he was also the guy responsible for blasting the music that everybody hated and eventually destroyed his radio. I was never on board with Sammy Sosa.
Not on with Slammin' Sammy?
Never. Not even in 99. Not even 98 during the home run war with McGuire.
Mm-hmm.
Never liked Sammy Sosa. Terrible outfielder. Really terrible.
But he likes baseball very, very much.
And he had a tendency to hit a lot of home runs when we were up 5 runs. That would be when he would crush them. He could hit the ball far and he could hit home runs. I never liked him.
Well, you know, that's just that was really the, would you call that the height of the steroid era?
Yeah.
And I'm not saying it's necessarily over, but...
Well, you know, I mean, they lost, because of the strike in the mid-90s, they lost a lot of fans, and they wanted to bring them back. So, of course, everybody was thinking, okay, they're juicing, and they're juicing the balls, too.
Yeah.
So the balls go flying out. So suddenly in 1997, 98, guys are hitting 60 home runs a year. And, you know, that doesn't happen very often. And when three guys are doing it, you know... But, yeah, no, I was never a Sosa guy. And we used to sit in the right field bleachers. I would harass the hell out of them. I would scream at him. People in the bleachers would be like, hey, man, why are you screaming at Sosa? I'm like, because he sucks. He's a terrible fielder. I'd say, like, get your head out of your butt, Sosa.
It's a bold, bold move.
I was making fun of Corey Patterson one time. Do you remember Corey Patterson?
I know Corey Patterson.
Okay, Corey Patterson would swing at the first pitch every single time he was up. Every single time. First pitch, then the second pitch, then the third pitch, and then he'd strike out, or maybe he would get a hit, or maybe he would ground out. But there was never a time when he just would swing at anything. He would swing at anything. If it was 7 feet over his head, he'd swing at it. So I'm... this is one of my favorites. They're playing... I can't remember. Griffey's team, Ken Griffey Jr. So they're playing... So Griffey's out in center field, okay? And my own guy is up. So Corey Patterson is up. And so I start screaming. I start screaming at him. He was on base. He was on second. So I think he'd walked or what? No, he didn't walk. Of course he didn't walk. Because he swings at everything. He's not going to walk. I don't know how he got on there, but he got on second base. So he was close enough for me to scream at him, and he can hear me. So Griffey's in center field. I'm in right center in the bleachers. And so the next, I can't remember who the next batter was, but the batter who's up, who was up right after Corey or a couple of batters after, he had a 3-0 count, okay? And I said, hey, Corey, you ever see one of those before? You know, 3-0 count. And then it went to 3-1. I was like, oh, 3-1, there's another count that you've never seen before. And I'm screaming this, and everybody around is like laughing about it. Ken Griffey turns around, looks at me, starts laughing. Like, looked right at me, put his glove up over his face, and kind of did like a thumbs up. My dad was sitting next to me. My dad still tells that story. Still tells that story. You were screaming at Corey Patterson, and Ken Griffey Jr. gave you the thumbs up. You got to love baseball. Yelling at guys.
It's America's pastime.
It's America's pastime. They used to have the gentleman special. No, what was it? Because they would have these late starts at Wrigley in the 90s, 220. At 220 they would start, and we would go to all those games. I can't remember what the businessman special. So they were 220 starts. We went to every game. We went to every 220 game, and and we drank a lot of beer. That was back when I was really giving Sosa a hard time, because this was in the 90s, and I was just like, we're drinking a bunch of beer, I'm screaming at Sosa. God, I would have punched me in the face. All right, let's take a break. We got more weird superstitions and rituals associated with sports that we're going to get to, and we'll do that right after we break for the news. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we're live, 18 stories of a beautiful downtown Chicago in the Skyline Studio. It's Tuesday, 2 for Tuesday. Yeah, man, 2 for Tuesday. One artist, two songs. You pick them. 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Who picked the AC/DC?
That's coming to us from Big Ed.
Big Ed. Like some AC/DC. All right. Hey, we've been talking about some hilarious and weird and just very strange rituals and superstitions that are associated with sports, and there seem to be a ton of them. And we got a bunch of texts coming in. Let's get through those, and then we got a whole bunch of more here to talk about in this article that is actually linked up on our Facebook page if you want to check the whole thing out. It's Bleacher Report did this article about it. Canadian Bill says, hockey superstitions, playoff beards. Yeah. I even do the playoff beard every year. I remember when
I unintentionally do the playoff beard.
In 2013, when they won the cup, I was scheduled to host, the night they won the cup, I was scheduled to host this theater, Lifeline Theater bingo event. I was going to be your master of ceremonies. And it was like a bingo event. No, a spelling bee. Sorry, it was a spelling bee. And so I was the host, and I had signed on for this long before we knew, you know, that there would be an integral, you know, a very important postseason game. Possibly the Hawks could win the cup. And, of course, you know what a big Hawks fan I am. And so my friend Allison, who is the managing director at Lifeline Theater, this back in 2013, was like, well, you don't have to come. We'll find somebody else. And I'm like, no. I don't want to do that. That's unprofessional. You know, I'll show up. But I just want you to know, I look like Aqualung. Because my beard is out of control. My beard was ridiculous. Like, it was ridiculous. And I said, I will be wearing a Hawks jersey. And, you know, there's a bar up in front. It was at Main Stage in Rogers Park.
Oh, yeah. Right by the
L.
Yeah.
Right by the L. So that was where it was. Main Stage. That's where we did it. And so, you know, there's a bar up front, like a restaurant, booths and stuff, and a bar,
yeah,
TVs,
there, yeah.
And then you walk to the back, and that's where the stage is. So the event was in the back, in the stage. And it was all for charity. It was all for this theater company, the Lifeline Theater. They do great work. And so I was excited to help out. And so, you know, we're in the back, and all of a sudden I hear, like, people cheering in the bar. And I'm like, because I was like, I had to do this event. And we took a break, an intermission, and I got to see, like, most of the second period. And then went back. And this is when they scored those two goals in, like, 17 seconds.
Yeah.
All right. And that was in the third period. So they were, at one point, they were down one. They were up one. Then they were tied. So all of a sudden, we go back. And I don't know how this happened. But the second half of the spelling bee, everybody misspelled everything, and it ended in like 15 minutes. And I was like, you're not throwing this for me. I was saying that, you guys aren't throwing this for me. And they're like, no, damn it, I'm mad that I didn't spell it right. But everybody was spelling it wrong, and just by process of elimination, we finally had a winner. And we were only there for 15 minutes. I got to watch the entire third period.
There you go.
But I felt weird.
Sure.
Because I've been to the Main Stage a couple of times. I didn't watch Hawks games there. I watched them at Ricochet's with my friends, with all my hockey friends. We had rituals, you know what I mean? So I felt really weird about being alone in Evanston, or Rogers Park, being alone in Rogers Park, and watching this game with a bunch of strangers in a strange environment. And with all these theater people who had no idea what hockey was, as opposed to my friends at Ricochet's getting drunk and talking about how great, you know, everything is. But they did end up winning the cup while I was there. It was the weirdest experience was to be in this place watching them win the cup in 2013. And then I had to wait to get in a cab and go to Ricochet's because it was a madhouse outside. It was nuts. So I waited like 45 minutes and finally I got out and I jumped in a cab and went back to Ricochet's and then, you know, we were all like home now and, you know. So, but that was the weirdest. That was one of the weirdest experiences I've had. Like, and my superstitions were like, ooh, I'm in the wrong place.
But you had the beard.
Oh my God, the beard. That was the craziest of all the, because I've done, you know, for, well, I mean, every postseason I do the beard. And, you know, obviously the longer that the season goes on, the bigger the beard gets. So, you know, 2010, 2013, 2015, my beard was nuts because they went on to win the cup. But yeah, that 2013 was the worst. 2013, I swear to you, I looked like Aqualung. I people who were there for like the event, you know, I tried to explain to them during breaks, look, I'm the biggest hockey fan in the world. I signed on to do this a couple of months ago. I apologize for my appearance, but I'm not shaving my beard. I wasn't going to shave my beard before this event because people would do double takes. That's how crazy I looked. I looked like a lunatic. How about this? More from Canadian Bill. Gretzky wouldn't get a haircut on the road. He did once and lost. He had bad hair anyway. Gretzky had a, well, a lot of hockey players at that time had mullets. The mullet was a big hockey thing, especially in the 80s. Yeah, I'm not going to make fun of Wayne Gretzky for having a mullet, because I had a mullet in the 80s, but lots of hockey players.
Big that, mullets.
Oh, yeah, they used to call it hockey hair. Before.
Well, it's still big now, you got it, but it's got to be a little bit more manicured.
Oh, well, yeah, but back in the 80s, it was ridiculous.
Just bad.
Oh, my God.
Now you got to have like the, you got to call it lettuce. Got to have a little lettuce in the back.
In 2002, Canadians won the gold medal in hockey at the Olympics. The reason why, the ice maintenance were from Canada, and they planted a lucky loonie at the center ice. The loonie is Canada's dollar coin. So that's why they won. Had nothing to do with the gameplay. Had everything to do with the coin that was buried in the ice. 404 area code says, look at some of the rugby traditions and rituals. For example, after a game during team songs, if you screwed up a verse, you had to shoot the boot. Which is, you'd fill up someone's shoe or used cleats with beer, and the same person who screwed up the verse had to slam the beer and redeem himself by singing the correct verse. If not, he had to slam another one and keep going till he got it right. Well, that's disgusting.
Yeah, but the songs are very important to rugby.
Really?
You have to know the songs. You have to.
Okay.
It's a really big deal.
All right.
Way bigger of a deal than probably should be.
I didn't learn that from Invictus, so I...
Yeah.
I 815 area code. For Ron, the millwright, says, it's not sports related, but when I used to work for a custom fab outfit, every time I had to perform a specific layout on part, I'd have to rotate the soapstone or pencil in my hand before and after every mark made. 217 area code says, all I know about superstitions I learned from Bull Durham. Boy, that got out of here in a hurry. That's my favorite line in Bull Durham. All right, how about Brian Urlacher's secret to success? Do we know Brian Urlacher's secret to success? We know that he has hair now.
Hair implants.
Prior to the Super Bowl 51 in Miami, the pregame ritual of Bears linebacker Brian Urlacher was revealed to the public. It doesn't involve crushing skulls or busting heads or anything you might imagine a future Hall of Famer linebacker to prepare for a football game. Urlacher likes to keep things chill for hours leading up to a big game. In the morning, he unwinds for an hour by watching his favorite fishing show on television. Once he gets to the stadium, Urlacher zones out and listens to music for a while. And he always likes to enjoy a pregame snack, which is two cookies, preferably chocolate chip variety. Oh, he's an old softy.
Still one of the scariest looking players I've ever seen.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Great guy, too. Just real nice.
Now he's got hair. I love that when he got inducted into the Hall of Fame, his bust had no hair. I mean, he had hair when they inducted him, but they were like, we got to go. He said, let's just go with how I looked when I was playing football, and that was bald.
It's the right thing to do.
It was weird when those billboards and those commercials started to pop up, because I never knew he had hair. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I just assumed he just shaved his head just because he shaved his head. And then when he showed up, it took a while for me to get used to the hair. It's still weird to see Urlacher with hair. How about this? Athletes are always looking for new ways to get a leg up on the competition, particularly when it comes to speeding up recovery time from injuries. Some players resort to performance-enhancing drugs, but former Angels teammates Steve Finley and Darren Erstad had a more mystical approach to healing. Finley reportedly received a pouch of healing minerals from a former Diamondbacks teammate during an injury-plagued season. Both players both wore the minerals around their necks, and the results would speak for themselves. Finley's batting average rose dramatically as he hit .350 over the course of 3 months. And Erstad had a hitting streak of his own and a precious stretch of injury-free play. Wow, all right. Precious minerals. All right, how about this one? We've heard this one before. Dirty, smelly articles of clothing are among the more unpleasant superstitions that an athlete can cling to. After all, for athletes, sweating and physical exertion are a major part of their job description, which means their unwashed laundry is likely to get stinkier at a much faster rate than, say, any laundry. assuming that a long night of scotch drinking doesn't count as rigorous physical activity. I don't think it does, but sometimes the visible stink lines emanating from an athlete isn't enough to change their filthy ways. For example, Steve Kline. Former Giants pitcher Steve Kline had a dirty hat tradition in which he would wear the same hat all season without ever washing it. He took pride in his grody hat and enjoyed seeing the new depths of filth it could reach by the end of each season. Kline said the dirt kept him grounded and reminded him where he came from.
Yeah, every other ballpark, I guess.
Serena Williams, if there's anything that's going to get nastier from constant unwashed wear than a hat, it's a pair of socks. At least tennis great Serena Williams only wears the same pair of socks throughout a single tournament run rather than 162 straight matches. Williams has blamed a change in her routine for tournament losses, so she tires to be vigilantly stinky. She tries to be vigilantly stinky. Then they talk about the playoff beard here, too. So, all right, we got more of these. You want to jump in, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Some weird, strange superstitions and rituals. Sports people are weird. So let's break here and come back and talk more. Right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How's it going? We are live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. I'm your overnight dude, 1 to 5 a.m. every weekday morning. And it's Tuesday. That means 2 for Tuesday. You mean 2 for Tuesday? Get your requests in now. You program all the music bumps that we play in each show, and today's theme is 2 for Tuesday. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. We've been talking about weird superstitions and rituals in sports, and then after the 3:30 news, we're going to jump into a little Fleetwood Mac talk. We'll talk some music. Tusk, the album Tusk, turned 40 just a couple of days ago. If that doesn't make you feel old, my God. But anyway, we're going to talk about that and that album and Fleetwood Mac and music in general, and we want to hear from you guys at 312-981-7200. We got a few more of these superstitions. NASCAR has some superstitions. It's quite understandable why NASCAR drivers would embrace certain superstitions. While a hockey or football player may weird it up with dirty socks or some other smelly ritual, they're merely trying to stay healthy or win a game. For NASCAR drivers, a bad day could very well mean a fiery crash. So it's a good idea to hedge your bets. First of all, no peanuts in the shell. An old superstition that dates back to the racing era before World War II, peanuts in the shell are almost never sold at or around NASCAR events. Peanut shells are considered bad luck, and according to racing lore, peanut shells were always found in the smoldering remnants of badly wrecked cars. What?
That's a very specific thing to be found.
It's weird. Also, no $50 bills. While the legend says that two $50 bills were found in the shirt pocket of championship racer Joe Weatherby after he was killed in a crash in 1964, no one knows how much the tale is rooted in truth. Regardless, $50 bills are non grata at NASCAR. Wow, I didn't know that.
That is eerie.
That is weird. How about Minnie Minoso? Minnie Minoso showered the stink off his uniform. According to an article in the Chicago Tribune, Minnie Minoso, who played with the White Sox in the 50s, had an interesting way of combating a hitless game. Apparently, he blamed the bad mojo on his uniform and wore it in his post-game shower to wash away the stink of the game. After his unorthodox shower, Minoso had 3 hits in the next day's game. His teammates were sold on the method, and following the game, they piled into the shower with all their uniforms on.
Hey now, everybody. Let's all get in the shower with the clothes on.
Richie Ashburn slept with baseball bats. Hall of Fame slugger Richie Ashburn had his own way of keeping a hot streak hot. anytime he had a particularly good day at the plate, he would be sure to use the same bat for as long as the success would last, and Ashburn went to extraordinary lengths to remain in possession of his lucky bats. Concerned that equipment managers couldn't be trusted to keep his bat separate from all other bats, Ashburn would take his bat of the moment with him each night. He made room in his own bed for his lucky bats. When in doubt, treat your bat like a special lady. Okay. Here's one we all know. The Sports Illustrated cover curse, the jinx. Like the Madden curse, the Sports Illustrated cover jinx has an irrational foundation. Some people swear it exists, and those people have 5 decades worth of evidence to back them up. But there is no bigger link between appearing on the magazine and finding misfortune than there is between that shirt you wore the last time your team lost. There are a lot of athletes and a lot of issues with Sports Illustrated. Any misfortune that an athlete or a team suffers after appearing on the cover is simply coincidence. So that being said, I have read through the impressive list of incidents attributed to this so-called jinx. And I have to admit that they make a pretty compelling argument. There were 12 incidents in 2012 alone. And I'm starting to think that there might be something to this jinx after all. We all do. Everybody knows about the Sports Illustrated cover. Okay, I love this one. Wade Boggs. I love Wade Boggs. I love Wade Boggs.
Responsible for one of the best episodes of It's Always Sunny.
And it's one of my favorite episodes of all time.
Gang beats Boggs.
Wade Boggs on the plane.
It's the ghost of Wade Boggs.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not dead yet.
Right. If you want to know the secret to making it into the Baseball Hall of Fame, 2005 inductee Wade Boggs might tell you it has something to do with poultry. In 1999, he revealed his entire career has been fueled not by steroids, but by chicken. Legend has it that during his rookie season, Boggs recognized some kind of correlation between his chowing down on chicken and games with multiple hits. He stuck to his superstitious diet religiously, and his wife accumulated more than 40 chicken recipes for the 3,000 chicken meals she was tasked to produce each season. 3,000 chicken meals in a season?
That's a lot of chicken, man.
Wow. There's only 162 games. I mean, what...
I mean, he's an athlete. He's probably eaten, you know, more than just a square 3 meals a day.
Wow.
He's out there. He's training. He's running.
They mentioned that chicken thing in that episode.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, here's the one that you talked about yesterday that you blew at a party, a no-hitter silence. Nice job, man.
Yeah, don't feel good about it.
The first rule of pitching a no-hitter is that you do not talk about pitching a no-hitter. The second rule of pitching a no-hitter is that you do not talk about pitching a no-hitter. Among baseball fans and players, silence during a potential no-hitter is like a sixth sense. Apparently, the mere mention of the word no-hitter is more than enough to immediately stop it in its tracks. It's difficult for non-baseball people to understand. Seconds before, this is from a 1996 article in the Los Angeles Times. Seconds before Trosper delivered the first pitch to Herrera, Stockton made an untimely utterance. He said, "Guys, Tanner has a no-hitter," Trosper said. Everyone was like, "Shut up, Ricky." No sooner than the words left Stockton's lips than the ball left Herrera's bat, reaching for an outside fastball. Herrera poked a triple into right field. I had that feeling like, oh no, he's going to get a hit. Trosper retired the side to salvage the shutout, but he missed out on every pitcher's dream. See, man?
I know.
All right. And then, let's see. The many curses of the Chicago Cubs. We'll close with this. You got the curse of the Billy Goat. We know about that. We got the curse of the Black Cat, 1969. We got the curse of Steve Bartman, which was not his fault.
No.
Routine double play ball. Anybody remember the routine double play ball? But yeah, I mean, it's, you know. So
I just remember how horrible the coverage was of that.
Yeah,
I mean, it was. I can't believe it.
I mean, it was
Didn't
it was heartbreaking.
Weren't there certain, I think there were some networks that actually put his phone number and address out
sometimes,
there.
Sometimes. Sometimes put his address in.
I just can't believe that.
No.
I can't believe how.
Guy's life changed in 10 seconds. His whole life changed in 10 seconds.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he's probably changed his name by this point.
I know. Yeah. He's been in hiding.
Mm-hmm.
And
I know they just
and it's not his fault. Moises Alou, man, relax.
Mm-hmm.
Relax, dude.
I know they put the
inning fell
out,
apart. But the inning fell apart before that incident.
Mm-hmm.
The wheels fell off of the train. I'm glad we're closing on that because that was really a fantastic night. And you knew they weren't going to win Game 7. You knew they weren't. You knew it. Next game. All right. All right, let's break here. Hey, Fleetwood Mac, we're going to talk about that and more on the 40th anniversary of Tusk. But news is coming up after this. Massive jam. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here until 5 o'clock. We have a Blackhawks Express to play from last night's game. Every morning after a night with a Blackhawks game, we always play the Express. It's a good one this morning. They won. They looked good, too. So you can hear all Blackhawks games right here on 720 WGN all season long and postseason long. So who requested the Sabbath?
It's coming to us from Ron, the millwright.
Have you ever heard the Al Jorgensen version of that song?
No, I'm not sure if I want to, though.
He didn't do it under the... No, it's actually not bad. He didn't do it under the under Al Jorgensen or Ministry. Look up Al Jorgensen. Look up Al Jorgensen Supernaut. And then you'll find... I can't remember the name of whatever act it was that he went under. Does it say anything?
Yeah, but I'm not going to say it.
Why?
It's the name is...
I don't remember the name being...
1,000 Homo DJs.
Oh, yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. But that's what he... You should listen to it. It's not bad. Yeah, Al Jorgensen. Covered Supernaut. So... we are talking about music here, and Fleetwood Mac. There was a time when Fleetwood Mac is still really popular. And they've had such a crazy career, and you know all of these soap opera stories and personal life issues and relationships and stuff. I don't know how you stay in a band, you know, with all of the stuff that went down. And then you write about it. Then everybody's writing about it. You
just
know?
Airing your dirty laundry, album by album.
It's crazy. What was it? Somebody wrote, Taylor Swift writes songs about... Taylor Swift writes songs... By the way, she's a curse to the LA Kings. I just thought I'd remind everybody. Taylor Swift writes songs about ex-boyfriends who broke her heart, or whose heart she broke. But Stevie Nicks writes songs about a guy that she was in a band with and then makes him sing them. So, yeah, it's the 40th anniversary. This year's the 40th anniversary of Tusk. It was released a few days ago, 40 years ago, a few days before this. And Tusk was and still is a challenging and weird record. And especially weird because it was a follow-up to Rumors. And they went in an entirely weird, different direction. And the album didn't sound anything like Rumors. And people were, you know, noticeably mad about that. See, you know, if you're not old enough to remember, Rumors was one of the biggest. I mean, all you got to do is, you know, look it up. Rumors was one of the biggest albums of all time. Classic album, one of the best albums of the 70s. and a mainstay in your record collection in the 70s. If you did not have a copy of Rumors in your record collection in the 70s, the police could legally kick down your door and arrest you. Oh, I'm sorry, I don't find Rumors in your record collection. You're going to jail. And there were a few albums like that. Another one that pops into my head is Frampton Comes Alive. That was another one that every single person in the 70s had. I'm sure there are a lot more. And I'm sure there are people out there thinking that there were, you know, that there were a lot more. That everybody... Oh, the soundtrack to Saturday Night Fever. Everybody had the soundtrack to Saturday Night Fever. But, yeah, but Rumors was one of those records that just would not go away. And I can't even remember how many hits are on that record. It's like almost every song on that record became a single and a hit. I mean, if you go down, find the track list for Rumors, and let's just go down the titles of these songs and listen to this. Because it's insane. It's insane if you think about this, especially at that time, because it was on the radio constantly, and Fleetwood Mac was the hottest ticket in the world at that time. There kind of wasn't really a bigger band at that time than when Rumors was out.
So you kick it off with Secondhand News.
Yep.
Followed by Dreams, Never Going Back Again, Don't Stop, Go Your Own Way, and Songbird, and that's just side one.
Yeah.
Side two opens with The Chain, You Make Love and Fun, I Don't Want to Know, Oh Daddy, and Gold Dust Woman.
See, what are we talking about, man?
So in terms of, I mean, I would say pretty much every song on side one, save two, have transcended the album. They're just classic rock staples.
Right.
Side two, probably The Chain and I Don't Want to Know. Not saying that the other songs are not great.
Gold Dust Woman, man.
Is that a pretty?
Oh, yeah.
So then you got three on side two that are
it's ridiculous. I mean, and that album, I mean, the impact that album made was massive, you know, and I think it won Album of the Year. I think it won. I mean, it was one of those deals where it was like that was the album of that time period. And I think it won all kinds of Grammys, and they were selling out every concert, you know, across the world. And they were also, you know, stoking the fires of all their personal stories and their interrelationships and stuff. And Rumors is a terrific album. It's a great album, and, you know, filled with really, really amazing songs that were also very personal and telling about who's sleeping with who in the band, because everybody was sleeping with everybody in the band. And there was soap opera stuff going on. There was drama in this band. And eventually people would get kicked out of the band and come back to the band. And this has been a constant thing for years and years and years with Fleetwood Mac. It's like, who's in the band this month? Who, you know, you go see Fleetwood Mac over the past bunch of years and you never know what the lineup's going to be. Because somebody's going to either be kicked out or somebody's going to leave or something's going to happen where they, you know, sometimes you won't even get the full band. But it's interesting because Fleetwood Mac, before Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks and everybody, you know, the Fleetwood Mac was a completely different band. They were a blues band. And they didn't sound anything like that sort of California Lindsey Buckingham kind of, you know, and, you know, Stevie Nicks gauzy dresses, let's spin around in slow motion kind of stuff. And Christy McVie's wonderful little pop songs that she would write. She's really underrated, by the way, Christy McVie, as a member of that band. But it was a completely different band. And so if people go back and listen to like the early Fleetwood Mac records, they're like, what?
Yeah, you put on Oh Well,
yeah,
parts one and two. It's all very, like, not that, you know, it wasn't guitar focused later, but this was a lot dirtier, a lot louder.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, they really changed their sound when Lindsey Buckingham came into the band. The sound completely changed. And so Rumors was it's when you think about it, it's nearly impossible to follow up a record like Rumors that had so much success, that was critically acclaimed, that everybody loved. It's hard to think of how you can follow that up without people being disappointed. You know, inevitably, if you follow up an album of that magnitude, a certain portion of the people are not going to like it and are going to be disappointed because it's not Rumors. But what they did as a follow-up to Rumors was one of the weirdest albums at that time. When I first heard it, I was like, what the hell is this? And it got trashed by a lot of critics. Radio stations hated it. People didn't understand it. And were like, what the hell is Tusk? What is this album? I don't understand this. This is a double album. It's your big, ambitious follow-up to one of the best and most popular albums ever recorded in the history of music. And this is what you're putting out? With this weird album cover with the dog? It's like a Polaroid with a dog on it? Tusk was the first single off the record. And, you know, marching band on it, and it's like 6 minutes long. And I remember when it first, when, you know, it was, because it was a big deal. It was like, oh, Fleetwood Mac has new material out. Oh, my God. And it's called Tusk. You know, and I remember, like, the loop playing it. Like, you know, man, here we go. And I remember Steve Dahl making fun of it. But then, you know, so you heard it, and I couldn't believe what I heard. And then I ended up buying the record because, you know, it was a follow-up to Rumors, and it was Fleetwood Mac, and they were the biggest band on the planet at that time, even though the song Tusk was like, what the hell is this? Bought the album, brought it home, and I was like, I don't even know what to say about this album. I have no idea. Years have passed, and I now like it. You know, I think it's a pretty great record, and I like it very much. And I think it was bold of them to do what they did. It's just that when you're used to all the songs on Rumors, and then you put this weird double album on, you're inevitably going to be disappointed. And that was my first reaction. And my reaction for many years was like, that album sucks. I don't want to, you know. But then I had to rediscover it years later. And now I like it, obviously. But 40 years ago, that album came out. And it made a massive impact, not in a good way. It took years before people, I think, went back and realized, you know, that it was a pretty, you know, pretty great and interesting record, because people were so mad when it came out. And then, you know, the internal crap that was going on within the band exploded again. And it became more about who's sleeping with who hates who's going to leave the band, who's going to be fired from the band. And the soap opera that was Fleetwood Mac kind of took over. And then was the album after Tusk? I mean, because after Tusk, Stevie Nicks' solo career took off. I mean, before Tusk, she released a solo record. And then after Tusk, it really took off. And then was the album after Tusk, was it Mirage?
It is Mirage.
Well, that's a long time, man. That's four years.
Yeah, they had a live album in between.
Yeah.
And then they released Mirage.
Which is a much more commercial album.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, and made at a time at the height of, like, who's sleeping with who and what's going on. Just the crazy history this band has. So what do you guys think? Fleetwood Mac is what we're talking about. I also have the best Fleetwood Mac songs here. So we're going to talk about some Fleetwood Mac great stuff. And then Ringer.com wrote a piece about this really weird album, Tusk, that's 40 years old this year. So we will... We will talk about that and more. Our phone lines and text lines are open at 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Let's break here for some weather, and we'll come back and talk Tusk, Fleetwood Mac, and more. 312-981-7200. Deep cut. Deep cut right there. All right. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Two for Tuesday here. Nick DiGilio. Give me two for Tuesday. One artist, two songs. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Hey, coming up at 5 o'clock is the opening bell. Coming up at 6 o'clock, Steve Cochran with your morning drive. And the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Fleetwood Mac's album Tusk turns 40. Or it turned 40. And it was a weird way to follow up, Rumors, as we were just talking about. And it was a really challenging and difficult record. Double album. They charged a ton for it when it came out. What, according to this article, it, maybe it was ahead of its time, but Tusk's double album breath might have stunted its commercial prospects in 1975 or 79. The 2X LP retailed for $16.98, which is around $50 adjusted for inflation. So $17 you're going to pay 1979 money. So just very, very strange that they did this. Now, Tom, you've seen Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah, I had the opportunity to see them with my dad. God, I want to say maybe 2009, 2010, somewhere in there. They played the Allstate Arena, and they had it was a big deal because they were all together again.
So Buckingham Nicks, McVie,
times two.
Yeah, and Fleetwood.
Yeah. And so it was a really special thing. We had we bought tickets right away the minute the tour got announced. And something that, weird about my house is that we loved Rumors, obviously, but we were a Tusk house. My dad was really into Tusk.
Mm-hmm.
He really thought it was a very cool album. Maybe he was trying to be a contrarian in some ways and be like, nah, Tusk, this is the one. This is the album right here. But he enjoyed a lot of really strange takes on pop music, and he really I think he really appreciated how different Tusk was from its predecessor. Because why do Rumors too?
Right.
No point.
Right. So that's the album that you, as a kid, you listened to Tusk.
Yeah. And it was born out of, you know, the punk era was really hitting full swing at this time, and a lot of bands were trying to contend with the fact that they were being looked at as old people music.
Mm-hmm.
Like Pink Floyd, Animals, which I think is one of their best, comes out of that because people are like, oh, who wants to hear a 50-minute guitar solo? And, you know, they're not really saying anything. They're not doing anything relevant. And then they release Animals, which is one of their most politically focused albums.
Yeah.
And pretty hardcore for them in terms of the sound. But I feel like Tusk is the same.
Well, there's been a lot written about Tusk over the past 40 years, and I got a few things here. This is from ringer.com, and by the way, that whole article about Tusk at 40, the album Tusk at 40, is linked up on our Facebook page if you want to check it out, which is why you should like our Facebook page and follow us right now. It's facebook.com/Nick D Show. Facebook.com/Nick D Show. One rumor goes that Stevie Nicks threatened to leave Fleetwood Mac if they actually called the album Tusk. There was nothing beautiful or elegant about the word Tusk, she later said. She's right. It's a grunt, a jab, a thudding monosyllable that has none of the musicality of the title that Nix was already dreaming up for her first solo record, Belladonna. In the liner notes to the album's 2004 reissue, Nix sets the scene. Shrunken heads and lathes and Polaroids and velvet pillows and saris and sitars and all kinds of wild and crazy instruments and tusks on the console. Photographs by the nature artist Peter Beard were scattered around for inspiration. Rare woods from Brazil and volcanic stones from Hawaii went into the decor. Nick's biographer Stephen Davis writes, all this ambiance, and Lindsey Buckingham still insisted upon some of the album, recording some of the album in the damn bathroom. It is also that rare album that could sell more than 4 million copies, spawn 6 hit singles, and relatively speaking, still be considered a flop. Well, when you have the kind of success that you had with Rumors, like we said, you know, 6 hit singles and 4 million copies being sold is really good. But the numbers for Rumors were astronomical and unheard of. Not many artists have to confront the mixed blessing of following up what was then the best-selling record of all time, and no one in Fleetwood Mac would have felt creatively satisfied if they just made Rumors 2. Still, few listeners or record executives could have quite anticipated the strange sprawl of Tusk, a record that over the years has earned numerous comparisons to the Beatles' White Album. I can see that.
Yeah, especially in terms of what they were trying to do with some of the recording techniques.
Yeah.
You know, just trying to break things up.
The year before he entered the studio to begin recording Tusk, Lindsey Buckingham saw The Clash live in London. The experience left him electrified, challenged, and a little bit personally offended. So he chopped off his flowing Led Zeppelin locks, traded in his bell-bottoms for skinny jeans and tailored suits. Started hearing beauty and dissonance, like the way recording on a boombox would give you a stark compressed sound, or the tone that you got from playing percussion not on a drum kit but an empty box of Kleenex. As a counterbalance to Buckingham's punk outburst, Tusk showcases some of McMee's most straightforward, lovely compositions. Opener Over and Over sets a rose-colored tone, while the understated Make Me Never Cry is a perennial tearjerker. Perhaps the most Rumors-reminiscent cut is McMee's rousing Think About Me, one of Tusk's few full band jams. Tusk wouldn't have confounded listeners if even half of its songs sounded like that, but Restless Shapeshifting was also a consistent part of Fleetwood Mac's ethos. So there it is. Yeah, it didn't get a great reception. So we're going to talk more about Tusk. It's 40, and then we're going to get into some of the best Fleetwood Mac songs. What are some of your favorite Fleetwood Mac songs? If you would like to join us, we would love to hear from you at 312-981-7200 right here on WGN.
Last night I thought I found.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the Skyline Studio in downtown Chicago, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. And we are here until 5 a.m. It's Two for Tuesday. Hey, man, Two for Tuesday. Wildcard Wednesday would be tomorrow. One artist, two songs, 312-981-7200. What do we got there? Who requested that?
So that was a little Bonnie Raitt requested by the 708.
All right. There it is. Okay, we're talking music here, and we're going to get into some of the best Fleetwood Mac songs of all time. We'll listen to a bunch of them, too. And this is in honor of a couple of days ago, their really challenging follow-up album to Rumors, Tusk, turned 40, if you can believe that. So we've been talking about this article that was written at Ringer.com, looking back at that album, which was a very, very strange record, especially at that time. But here's what they say about it. 40 years later, it remains the blueprint for what comes after astounding commercial success. If an artist is too itchy and creative to simply rest on their laurels, its forward-thinking ethos has kept it fresh all this time. Tusk is not going to sound dated in five or 10 years, said writer Blair Jackson predicted all the way back in 1981. He says also, and I would be willing to bet that a lot of people will slowly be convinced of the album's greatness, then will forget about it. So, there it is. Yeah. It's interesting to go back and think about that time period, because I vividly remember when the record came out, and the response to it. It was crazy. It really, really was crazy. So. So if you want to jump in here, we're talking, we were just talking about Tusk turned 40, and now we're going to talk about Fleetwood Mac in general. I've got a list here from Rolling Stone about the best Fleetwood Mac songs. They got a lot. So what are your favorite Fleetwood Mac songs? We already got some texts coming in. Phone lines, text lines are open. We're talking Fleetwood Mac, 312-981-7200. 773 area code says, my favorite Fleetwood Mac song is Rhiannon. Smash hit. 387 area code says, morning guys, Anne from Dublin, Ireland. Oh, I love that place. Favorite Fleetwood Mac song is Sarah. Yeah, that's a Stevie Nicks song right there. Man, they had a lot of good songs. They just did.
Well, is it true? I don't know how true this is. Wasn't Sarah, it was called that because it was named after a child that she was going to have with a member of the Eagles?
I think you're right.
Yeah.
I think that's the story behind it.
And they decided not to have the child, but she said that if I had a kid, it was a girl named her Sarah.
Yeah. It's funny. I've never seen Fleetwood Mac. I've seen Stevie Nicks. So, I still love that. I really, really, really love that scene in School of Rock where, Jack Black takes Joan Cusack out for a beer and goes to the jukebox and plays Edge of 17. I just love Joan's reaction to it.
You still have it. Yeah, she get a couple beers in her, she'll dance around like Stevie Nicks.
Yeah. But I just think it's really, I mean, I love, that's one of my favorite scenes. It's actually because of Joan Cusack's reaction to it. Like her reaction to hearing like the beginning of Edge of 17, she just starts to get all crazy and excited and, that's a movie, by the way, I cry during the last 10 minutes of that movie every time I watch it. When they do the performance of School of Rock, gone.
Very jubilant.
Gone. So, all right. Let's see. 312-981-7200. Here's Tom on WGN. Hi, Tom. Tom?
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
It's a long way to the top if you want to rock and roll.
That's right.
Hey, listen, I'm into the deep cuts. I'm a big music guy, but I really appreciate that song Angel on Tusk.
Mm-hmm.
Not one that you really ever heard on the radio, and, you know, it's a very good song.
Can you believe it's 40 years old? Can you believe Tusk is 40 years old? It's crazy.
It is. It's bizarre.
It is. It's too much.
Hey,
yeah.
Quick question. Did Shagru go to Northern?
Yes.
Your buddy?
Yes, he did.
Did he?
Yeah.
Was he an SA? All right, because I went to Northern. We're the same age, and he's got to know a few of my buddies. I was just curious.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, very cool. All right, I went to Gordon. I know you're a Pats guy. Cool.
I'm not a Pats guy.
No.
I went to Luther North.
Oh, okay.
Dan Shagru, my former producer, was a Pats guy.
And he went to Pats, and then he went to Northern.
Yes.
All right.
Okay.
Well, very cool.
Take care, Tom.
I really enjoy your show,
Thanks,
man.
Buddy. Okay.
See ya. Well,
my former producer, Dan Shagru. So, hey, can you pull a little bit of that Angel song?
Absolutely.
So this is from Tusk. This was Tom's, one of his favorite songs, a deep cut off of the 40-year-old album, Tusk, Angel. Yeah, it's a good song. It's a good song. You know that they're using Go Your Own Way on like a prescription drug commercial?
What?
Are you not familiar with this?
No.
There's a commercial that's airing pretty regularly on TV, and I can't remember what it's for, but it's for a prescription drug. I think it's actually about depression. I think the drug is to help you with depression.
Hmm.
And it's not the actual, it's a cover, obviously. It's somebody else doing it, but they're using Go Your Own Way. Now, I don't know if this company knows that, but Go Your Own Way is about a breakup.
Yeah.
Like a pretty, you know, personal and severe breakup. So I don't know. We've talked about this before. It's like the misuse of songs.
Yeah.
Not just in commercials, but in TV shows and movies and stuff like that.
You know, I figured if they were going to use Go Your Own Way in a medical commercial, it'd be for like constipation medicine.
Well, yeah. Like I can't remember what it's for. It's prescription meds, though. I know for sure it's prescription meds. Because it makes me nuts. Every time I hear it, I'm like, well, do you guys know the history of this song? What this song is really about? What this song means and what it represents to the people who wrote it? I'm not granted they signed off on it. Fleetwood Mac had to sign off on it. You know, so they're making some dough, but it just seems really, really, really weird to me that's the song that they're using on a prescription med commercial. I don't know.
That was Chris from Midway just gave us a quick call. It's Chantix to help you quit smoking. With the cold turkey.
No. The turkey's not in the commercial, I can tell you that.
But it's the same company.
It's Chantix. Yeah, okay, he's right. But it's not the turkey. The turkey commercials are cool. I like that little turkey. Not as much as I like the bladder, the cute little bladder on the bladder control meds commercial. Because, yeah, I guess it is Chantix. So Chantix or whatever it is.
Is that what's his name from Goodfellas?
Ray Liotta.
Yeah, Ray Liotta. Yeah. He was Chantix. Yeah.
Yeah. Those are weird. Those are weird commercials.
He was looking, he just looked rough.
Like, where have you been, Ray? You think you've been dragged through the gutter for a few days. He's like,
it looks like a beaten steak. Like,
my God.
Poor guy.
And he's like cooking with his family and just looks like he doesn't want to be there.
He's probably just thinking to himself, man, if only.
If only I could get a, if I could have a smoke, everything will be fine. No, those were weird. I thought those commercials were weird. And God bless him if, you know, if he.
Sure, it's good that he quit.
If he quit smoking by using that helped him, that's great. But those commercials are just weird. So, all right. Do you have a favorite Fleetwood Mac song?
Favorite one? Probably, I would have to say Never Going Back Again, because it's some of the most beautiful guitar work I've ever heard.
Mm-hmm.
And same thing with Bleed to Lover. You know, actually, it's Bleed to Lover.
Okay.
I love it, especially the live version that they do on The Dance from 1997. That really, I really love that song.
Okay. So let's take a break here. We're talking Fleetwood Mac. We want to hear from you guys. We also have a very exciting and very good and very fun first win of the season, Blackhawks Express, to play back this morning. But we want to hear from you. We're talking best Fleetwood Mac songs, your favorite Fleetwood Mac songs, and the stories about them. 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the WGN Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here till 5. I'm here every weekday morning, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. And Steve Rosanich has the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran has your morning drive at 6. It's Tuesday, 2 for Tuesday. Yeah, 2 for Tuesday. We've been hearing some 2 for Tuesdays all morning long. 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. We'll be playing back the... Hawks, Blackhawks Express, as we do the morning after every game, and their first win of the season, and that was a really good game, and the highlights are going to be fun to listen to, so that's coming up. Welcome back, everybody, 312-981-7200. We're talking Fleetwood Mac. Fleetwood Mac's album, Tusk, a couple of days ago turned 40, if you can believe that. Man, I'm old. Phantasm turned 40 this year. Alien turned 40 this year. Come on, man. yeah. Old. So, we're talking about our favorite Fleetwood Mac songs, and we've got a bunch of texts coming in. 312 area code says, "Don't Stop," which, of course, is classic. 847 area code says, "Monday Morning." 708 area code says, favorite Fleetwood Mac song is Rattlesnake Shake. Oh, going back in time for that one. Favorite Fleetwood Mac song from the 773 area code says is Little Lies.
I've got a very soft spot for Little Lies. I think it's a great song.
Let's hear a little bit of, why don't you find Little Lies? We'll play a little bit of that. And then also 815 area code says Hypnotized is a good song. Talking Fleetwood Mac. 312-981-7200. Rolling Stone picked out their favorites. I know what my favorite is. What do we have a little bit of them?
Yeah, here's a Little Lies. Little Lies.
Tell me lies. Tell me sweet little lies. Tell me lies. Oh, no, no, you can't disguise. No, you can't disguise. Tell me lies. Tell me sweet little lies.
Mm-hmm. So here's what they say about this. This is mentioned among the best Fleetwood Mac songs in this Rolling Stone article. Christine McVie wrote this song with Portuguese songwriter and keyboardist Eddie Quintela, whom she married in 1986. The band's last top 10 hit, Little Lies, showed that McVie was still able to effortlessly tap into the restless longing that's infused her best songs. Her writing ability all stems from the blues. My writing ability all spins from the blues. Don't Stop, Say You Love Me. They all have that boogie bass left-hand thing. even the more recent things like Little Lies. She later mused that Fleetwood Mac should have unearthed this song and not Don't Stop when they performed at Bill Clinton's inauguration. That's pretty funny. That's pretty good. God, I remember during the campaign and Bill Clinton's inauguration, I mean, they played Don't Stop. Like, it was just constant. So, here are some of the other ones that they mentioned here in the article. I Know I'm Not Wrong. I Know I'm Not Wrong sums up the eccentric basement recording feel that Buckingham brought to Tusk. It's a simple yet sublime Beach Boys style melody over fuzz guitar. It sounds uncannily like the playful indie rock of the 90s, bands like Pavement. Punk and new wave have kicked in, Buckingham said. It gave me a kick in the pants in terms of to have the courage to try shake things up a little bit. His bandmates gave him room to explore. As Fleetwood said, if a song needs someone hitting a Kleenex box instead of snare drums, then we're going to hit a Kleenex box. That's it. I Know I'm Not Wrong. Yeah, man. It's crazy to see how different that Tusk is from some of the other stuff that was out, not just by Fleetwood Mac, but what was popular on the radio at that time. Because it was pretty much unlike anything on the radio, combined different styles of music in a kind of a pretty challenging way. So to go back in time and listen to that, to Tusk, you know, and think about that time period in 1979 when that record came out, it was kind of like nothing. It was kind of like nothing on the radio or nothing that was out there. Let's see. Next one here, they talk about is Songbird. It took Christy McVie only 30 minutes to write this lovely piano ballad. I wrote the chords and words and the melody almost as if it were coming from someone else and not me, she said. It was recorded in an empty auditorium in Berkeley and used as the B-side to Dreams. In his autobiography, Fleetwood said, we wanted the song to sound like Chris was singing at the end of the night after a show to an empty house. The song hit especially hard for the author's ex. When Christine played Songbird, grown men would weep, said John McVie, and I did every night. Oh. So I'll tell you my favorite. Maybe we can play a little bit of it. My favorite Fleetwood Mac song, and I got a lot of them. I really love Sarah. I really love Gypsy. I really love The Chain. I think I gravitate towards the Stevie Nicks stuff because my favorite, like by far, my favorite Fleetwood Mac song is Landslide. Which just, I think it's one of the greatest songs ever recorded. It's so good that Billy Corgan couldn't ruin it. That's how good a song Landslide is. It's like, wait a minute. Billy Corgan did a good cover of Landslide? This must be a foolproof song. Billy Corgan can't ruin it. I also love it for many, many reasons, but I also love the way it was used in... seven seasons ago on South Park when it ended the season with the divorce and everything was crap coming out of people's mouths. And it's one of my favorite episodes ever. And the use of it was beautiful. Like it was really, really beautiful. They used it beautifully on South Park. But I love this is my favorite Fleetwood Mac song.
Can I sail through the changing ocean tide?
Beautiful song, man. Oh, she was only 27 when she wrote that song, and that's a pretty reflective song for a 27-year-old to write. I wrote it in 73, a year before, and I joined Fleetwood Mac. And you can feel really old at 27. It is her acoustic meditation on growing up and the passing of time with her brooding I'm Getting Older Too, a surprising sentiment on 70s rock radio, yet Landslide became an AOR staple, has grown throughout the years. The Dixie Chicks take it to a new audience with their country version. Nix wrote Landslide. She and Buckingham had been in L.A. for 2 years. She waitressed at a singles bar, and she remembers how beautiful and frightening it all was, asking each other, now what? Should we go back to San Francisco? Should we quit? We were scared kids in this big, huge, flat city. We had no friends and no money, but we didn't quit, and the world has been taking Landslide to heart ever since. That's my favorite Fleetwood Mac song. So let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We're talking more Fleetwood Mac, and we'll listen to a little bit more. We want to hear from you guys at 312-981-7200. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. The opening bell is at 5. Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. And we are here live, and it's 2 for Tuesday. Wrapping it up. 2 for Tuesday. Who was that, and who requested it?
So that is coming to us from Greg H. The band is called Delirium. The song is Silence.
Okay. Well, there you go. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Fleetwood Mac's album Tusk turned 40 a couple of days ago, if you want to feel really old. And we've been talking about that and some of the other Fleetwood Mac songs and some of the other Fleetwood Mac stories. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. Coming up in another few minutes, we'll have the Blackhawks Express from last night's victory, their first win of the season. So that's good. But let's get back to the Fleetwood Mac talk here. 312-981-7200 for Talking Tech. Here's John on WGN. Hi, John.
Hi, Nick. I got an interesting Fleetwood Mac story. Sometime after the album Mirage, Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks left the group. And so they replaced them with Dave Mason, who was with Traffic, and Becca Bramlett, who was the daughter of Bonnie Bramlett from Delaney and Bonnie.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they were going to... There was this concert that was announced up near Dubuque. There's a little speedway up there called, in a town called Farley. And so I headed on out to the concert, but I kind of delayed going because I assumed that there were going to be probably a couple opening bands because it was Fleetwood Mac. So anyway, I get up to Dubuque and I get to Farley, and it's kind of like 10 or 15 miles outside of Dubuque. And when I arrived, all the people were like, kind of streaming out of the town. And so I walked up to this guy and I said, what's going on? He said, well, the show's over. And he said that the band got done. They said they were the only act on the bill, and they all jumped in the limousine and left Speedway as soon as the concert was over. So they must have been at a low point.
Yeah, must have been. Wow.
Oh, that was, they had the album Time Out, which supposedly was the lowest selling Fleetwood Mac album of all time.
Yeah. Wow.
Have you ever heard the song Purple Dancer by Fleetwood Mac?
Yes, I have.
Oh, it's like only on a 45, but it's really good.
Yeah.
I also like, oh, well, there's a song called Paper Doll.
Yeah.
And I also like Hold Me.
Yeah, those are great. They have so many different and great songs, too, man. They're a great band.
I just saw an album in a record store, and it was on a label called Parachute, but it was Fleetwood Mac. So I'm wondering if they didn't get dropped by Warner Reprise.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Uh-huh. That's a good question. All right, John, thanks.
Okay, I'll talk to you again.
Take care, man.
Bye.
Here are some of the other ones that people love. Do you like Big Love?
Yeah. I'll say this much about Big Love. I'm impressed by the guitar work. I'm impressed by what they're going for. But I was never super a big fan of the song. I thought it was just weird.
Yeah.
At least it inspired the Bill Paxton TV show, I guess.
It's it is a strange song. It is a strange song. And it was from Tango in the Night, which is a weird record in general. So yeah. Hey, let's play a little bit of Sarah. That's yet another one. This is It was released in December of 1979. This somber, elegant ballad was Fleetwood Mac's first hit of the 80s. Don Henley of the Eagles claimed the song was named for a baby that was pregnant with and decided not to have after their brief late 70s affair. 35 years later, she confirmed that that was partially correct. Had I married Don and had that baby, and she had been a girl, I would have named her Sarah, she said in 2014. But there was another woman in my life named Sarah who shortly after became Mick's wife, Sarah Fleetwood. So, yeah, that story is true, and it was Don Henley. And they recorded a duet, Don Henley and Stevie Nicks. No, that's Whenever I Call You Friend is Kenny Loggins. Stop Dragging My Heart is Tom Petty. What's the one that she did with Don Henley?
Let's see.
Because she did.
I'm trying to think.
Whenever I Call You Friend was Kenny Loggins. Stop Dragging My Heart Around was Tom Petty.
Leather and Lace.
Leather and Lace. That's Leather and Lace. That was the Don Henley duet that they did. So, all right. Do we have a little bit of Sarah? Great song. God. Another beautiful song.
It just reminds me how great of a piano player is Christy McVie.
Oh, she's great.
Unbelievable.
It's what's amazing about Fleetwood Mac is when it all comes together.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like when everybody has their own strength and they're a very diverse band and sometimes they didn't get along. Sometimes they hated each other. Sometimes they didn't even want to be on the same stage, but they were so good at what they each did, you know, or individually. That when it came together, it was like magic.
Yeah. No, so sometimes you need that tension. Sometimes that's where the great art comes
from. Well, yeah. I mean, you know, there are so many bands that have had a lot of tension, you know.
Have any of the members of The Who ever actually liked each other?
I don't think so.
I think maybe Entwistle and Moon had like a little bit of like, we're the rhythm section.
Yeah. I mean, obviously you've got like Black Crowes and you've got Oasis and those guys and wanted to kill each other. The Kinks.
Mm-hmm.
How great are the Kinks? They hate each other.
What is it about that?
I don't know.
What is it about that energy?
I don't know. Can you pull up Gypsy? Pull a little bit of Gypsy. I really do gravitate towards the Stevie Nicks songs.
Well, it seems to me that even people who love Fleetwood Mac, they're a little bit either you love Stevie or you hate her.
Oh, I love her.
Yeah. Some people really did not buy into the witchy woman stuff.
I don't care. These songs are great. How can you not like
great.
Who doesn't like Sarah? Who doesn't like Gypsy? Gypsy's a beautiful song.
I was once accosted in a Wendy's for wearing a Fleetwood Mac shirt.
I know, you told me the story.
Yeah, someone told me she looked and sounded like a goat.
She looked and sounded like a goat. That's real nice. So, do we have Gypsy, a little bit of Gypsy here? How can you not like that song? What's wrong with you if you don't like that? Is there something wrong with people? That's a great song. It's a beautiful song.
Well, I've always appreciated female lead singers with a little bit of a deeper voice.
Oh, I think she's great.
Yeah.
I've always loved Stevie Nicks. Always, man. I like her solo stuff. I like the stuff that she did with Fleetwood Mac. Always liked her. All right, let's play another one before we break for the weather here. Play a little bit more. Now, this one, if you saw the movie The Kitchen with Melissa McCarthy, Tiffany Haddish, and the lovely Elizabeth Moss, then you heard this song 750 times. Tom, did you see The Kitchen?
No. Once you gave your review of it, I was on the fence.
Yeah.
Because, like you, I very much enjoy
all three of those ladies, especially Elizabeth Moss.
I'm okay on McCarthy, but the other two, yes. Yeah. But once you told me how you felt, I was just going to wait.
I was really looking forward to it. Female gangster movie takes place in the 70s in Hell's Kitchen, and it was terrible. It was terrible, but we got to hear The Chain. You got to hear The Chain. They played it like 900 times in the movie because they were like, let's capture the 70s and we'll play The Chain 900 times during the course of the movie. I'm not kidding. Like 10 times they played Fleetwood Mac's The Chain in the movie. And of course I love the song, so it was fine, but it didn't help. It didn't help the movie at all. So here's a little bit of The Chain from The Kitchen. Another great song. Yeah, that's a great song.
I just love it. Hey, you know how we know it's the 70s? The Chain.
Now, that's what the logic was behind it. I'm not kidding. They played it. They played it like 10 times during the course of that movie. Of the final credits, even. It's like, how many times are you going to play The Chain? Not, you know, and again, I'm not complaining because I like Fleetwood Mac and I love that song, but couldn't you pick a couple of other songs from the 70s instead of going back to The Chain over and over and over again?
Yeah, you have an entire decade of rock music you could use as a touch point for all your... Guardians of the Galaxy managed to do it.
Yeah. Guardians of the Galaxy did it and did it beautifully. Beautifully. So, anyway. All right. And the reason why we're talking about Fleetwood Mac is because Tusk turned 40 this week. And when we come back, we'll play a little bit of that title track. A little bit of Tusk. Bring everybody back to the marching band days of Fleetwood Mac. All right. We're breaking here for the weather, and then after the commercials, we'll go straight to the Blackhawks Express. Hawks got their very first win of the season last night. Terrific game. They look good. It's going to be a fun Express to listen back to, as we do every morning after a Hawks game. Chicago!
Chicago Blackhawks seven-game homestand continues tonight as they try to claw their way into the win column for the first time this season. And to achieve that, they'll need to put a loss on the best team in the National Hockey League, the Edmonton Oilers, who, oh, by the way, are led by some guy named Connor McDavid. Well, they drop the puck at center ice. They're going to do it all over again. Now they drop it, and we're underway. The Hawks control. Murphy swings a pass quickly on the right wing to the Oiler line. David Kampf is there into the zone to the slot. Kubalik shoots. Puck save made by Mike Smith. Boy, that's 10 seconds of pretty good action right there, and a great chance for Kubalik. Now Strom picks the puck off at the Oiler line to Kane. Left circle. He shoots. Where is it? Oh, Smith knocked it just wide. I thought that had slid into the net.
Dylan Strome raised his hands. He thought it was in.
Nurse over the Hawk line on the right wing to Dreisaitl. Down the right boards. He centers. Picked off by Murphy. Headman pass. Caggiula on a break over the Oiler line to the net. He shoots. Turned out of there with the glove of Smith. Murphy fires from the right point. That missed the net. They're going to face it off in the circle to Smith's right one more time. And the draw between Strome and the Oiler player. Kane shoots and scores! Strom won it over to Patrick Kane from near the slot. He fired it off the right post and it ricochets in behind Mike Smith. And the Blackhawks take a 1-0 lead on the Oilers with 15:49 left in the second. Puck taken by Pearson behind the net. Oh, he's leveled by Andrew Shaw with a thunderous check. And now the Oilers are all after Shaw. It's Jujhar Kara grabbing hold of Shaw, trying to get him into a scrap. The draw. Murphy's got the puck. He'll pass out the sod at center ice. carries, and he broke through the defense, moves in and shoots. He hit the post. Nylander intercepts the puck. Here's Nylander, the Oilers' own sharp angle shot. He scores! His second goal as a Hawk. His first one came over in Prague. And a hustling play by Alex Nylander into the right circle in the Oilers' zone. Fired it along the ice, and he beats Smith. It's 2-0 Hawks with 13:40 left in the third. Kasson moves it to the left point platform to Draisaitl, top of the right circle, and Nugent Hopkins fed it across. They score. So the shutout for Corey Crawford ends with 2:11 left in the third period. It's James Neal with his eighth goal on the season, which is one better than he had all last year with the Calgary Flames. It's a power play goal, and it's now 2-1 in favor of the Hawks. Camp has it to Saad. The pass hit his skate, ricochets down ice. Saad is first to the dots. Oilers own drop pass. Taves moves in front. Got a shot away, not much on it. Blocked. Here's a loose puck in front. They score! It's Saad! David Camp kept the puck in the paint of the Oilers crease as he was battling two Oilers. And Saad came in from down the slot and poked it over the line. It's an empty net goal. And the Hawks lead the Oilers 3-1 with 32 seconds left in the third. Shaw will send it lazily into the left wing corner in the Oilers zone and watch it go behind the net with 3 seconds, 2-1, and the Hawks win their first game of the 2019-20 season and they end the Oilers winning streak at 5 games to start this season. The Hawks are now 1-2-1 on the young campaign, and the Oilers sustain their first loss of the year as the Hawks prevail 3-1.
Yeah, man. That's the kind of Blackhawks Express I like to hear. By the way, I was telling you off the air, Andrew Shaw leveled that guy. And it was a clean hit, too. Totally clean hit. He just, oh, man, Shawzy. Oh, man, that's what he does. That's what he does. But no, I'm telling you, you got to see that hit. I know you didn't see it, but you got to see it. You got to see the highlight of that hit. Unbelievable. Next game is Friday.
Yeah, Friday.
And they're hosting, why am I blanking on who they're hosting? Wait, Dave's here. Dave will help me. Dave, I know it's
going to be, it's another Columbus.
Oh, Columbus, right? Is it Columbus? Okay, there you go. Thank you, Dave.
Yeah, no. No problem, Nick.
I
just trying
it.
To suit up.
Yeah, I got you. He's getting ready. He's doing the sports all morning long. And Mary's here in traffic, too. They always get here right around the same time before 5 o'clock. So there they are. All right. By the way, coming up, the news is next at the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. So we've been talking Fleetwood Mac because Tusk turned 40. The album Tusk turned 40. Again, I keep saying that to myself like I cannot believe it. The title track was the first single off of Tusk. And people were like, huh? When they heard it. And I was one of those people who went, what? But this is the title track, Tusk. It's 40 years old.
Don't say that you love me.
Then there's this. What's happening?
It's called a drum solo, Nick.
What's going on there? That doesn't sound anything like "Go Your Own Way." I don't understand. I don't understand what's going on. But they were a band that reinvented themselves about 3 times, though.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So here's Roosevelt on WGN. Hey, Roosevelt.
Hey, Nick.
Hey.
Good morning. How you doing this
morning? All right. What's up?
When you mention Fleetwood Mac, 3 things come to mind.
Yeah.
XRT, because XRT used to play a lot of Fleetwood
Mac.
Yes,
they did.
Especially the early stuff, and that's what I'm referring to. Peter Green and Black Magic Woman. He's, you know, everybody thinks that Santana wrote it, but it was, I believe, Fleetwood Mac when Peter Green was in the band.
Yeah. And they were a completely different band, too, when Peter Green was in the band.
They were a bluesy band.
Yep, absolutely.
And Nick, they did some recording here in Chicago in the early days. They did a lot of blues stuff here in Chicago back in the, I'd say 1967 or
right.
68 or so.
Right.
But also what comes to mind is how underrated Lindsey Buckingham is as a guitarist.
Mm-hmm.
And that guy, to me, is a genius. He's one of the best guitarists that doesn't get a lot of credit for.
I think you're right. You're absolutely right, yeah.
So.
Yeah. All right, Roosevelt. Thanks, buddy.
Thanks.
Take care. Yeah, you got to mention Peter Green. You got to mention Peter Green and that era. Great stuff came out of that era. No question about it.
Yeah, one of the first songs I learned on the guitar was Oh Well.
Yeah.
Because it's a great riff.
And Lindsey Buckingham, star of What's Up With That.
I love that bit, not just because it's Lindsey Buckingham, but because how much more random of a guest could it be? Yeah, Lindsey Buckingham from Fleetwood Mac.
And just
Bill Hader just doesn't say anything.
Hader doesn't say anything. You just look at Bill Hader's face, which immediately makes me smile. Whenever I see Bill Hader, I immediately go, oh, it's Bill Hader. He rules. Even when he's killing people on Barry.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. And then when the real Lindsey Buckingham showed up for the last one that they did.
So funny.
Now, you know, when Keenan leaves, they got to come back and do one.
They'll do one, I guarantee.
They've got to come back. Armisen has to come back. Forte has to come back. Of course, Sudeikis with the red tracksuit has to come back.
Yeah.
And, of course, Hader.
That's Lindsey Buckingham.
The first time I saw that sketch, I'm telling you, man, my ex-wife and I, we could not stop laughing. We were like, because I tape it. You know, I DVR it and I tape it every week. And soon, when it was over, we were like, we're going to have to watch this again, because what the hell was that? And yes, it was one of the funniest things I've ever seen, and also one of the stupidest things I've ever seen. So, anyway. This article that we were talking about Tusk at 40, is linked up on our Facebook page. It's a really, really good article. We only scratched the surface, and it goes into much detail about the album, about what it feels like now and how it sounds now. It's a great article. So you should like us on Facebook right now and read it. Facebook.com/NickDShow. Speaking of music, our good friend Jim Ryan is going to join us tomorrow to talk all kinds of music. He goes to concerts. He reviews a lot of shows, and he goes to does interviews and all that kind of stuff. We always have a blast when Jim is down here. It's one of my favorite guests. So we're going to talk music with Jim Ryan, and we'll play some Rock of Ages, little music trivia with Jim.
May have to go over some of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame fan poll.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Warren Zevon?
No,
of course not. We'll play a round of Know Your Onion, and of course, it's Wild Card Wednesday. That's all coming up tomorrow on the show right here, and from 1 to 5 a.m. So, yeah, we'll do the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, too, and maybe we can just mention Warren Zevon all morning long.
Just a little bit?
Yeah. Not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Never been nominated. Bon Jovi's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, everybody. Def Leppard's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I just want to let people know that.